My name is Matthew Libre, and I am joined here today with Richard Crabtree. The date is May 10th, 2020, and this interview is being conducted over the phone with the Dartmouth Vietnam Project. I am calling from Cabin John, Maryland, and Mr. Crabtree is speaking with me today from Grand Junction, Colorado. I would like to start today by expressing my thanks to you, Mr. Crabtree, for speaking with us today. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, likewise.
And just to begin, where and when were you born?
I was born November 12th, 1946, in the beautiful campus of Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, Mary Hitchcock Hospital. And Dr. Boardman was the doctor.
And how exactly did you end up in Hanover? Can you tell me a little bit about your family?
Yes, my dad was a student at Dartmouth before the war. He was from Chicago, Illinois. And so World War II progressed to where he became a fighter pilot, Army Air Force P-47 fighter pilot for the duration. And he was last 8 months of the war, he was a POW. And all he could think about when being a POW was being able to get back to Dartmouth College. And so meanwhile, when he returned from Europe, he got together with my mother, who was his high school sweetheart, and she promptly became pregnant. And they went back, they moved to Dartmouth College and Hanover together as man and wife. And I popped out November 12th. Yeah.
Can you describe at all your initial experience at Dartmouth? Where did you live? How
yes.
long were you there for?
Yeah, our first home was Middle Fairweather Hall. It was designated as the married student's dorm. I guess maybe there were a couple of them. But I was there until, I only have one... One very vague memory being a two-year-old, a three-year-old. We moved back to Chicago when I was going on 3 years old, or my folks moved back to Chicago. And, of course, took me with them. So, meanwhile, that's my initial experience at Dartmouth. I just have a vague memory of when my mom was, I was in a stroller bassinet type thing, and just have vague memories of being a kid, a little baby, feeling snowflakes landing on my face, and I was having a good time catching snowflakes in my mouth. It's like one of my earliest recollections.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's still snowing at school, I'll tell you. Did you have any siblings growing up?
Yes. My brother Blair was born 4 years later in Chicago. And then I had another brother, Scott, and a brother, David.
Wow. Several of you. And can you describe what it was like to grow up in Chicago? Were you mostly there, or do you have any recollections? Were you moving at all?
Now, let's see. We lived in Chicago until I was 4 or 5. And my folks moved to Battle Creek, Michigan from Chicago. And my dad was involved with a small company called the Michigan Dock Company. And is sold and installed boat docks on the Great Lakes. And that was in Battle Creek, Michigan. And yeah, I was in kindergarten. I remember going through, as a kid, school project, going through the Kellogg cereal factory, which is quite something. Very memorable event.
Yeah.
And so let's see. From Battle Creek, Michigan, we moved to St. Louis, Missouri. And my father started work with McGraw-Hill Publishing Company then. I believe it was the F.W. Dodge section of McGraw-Hill. And he sold advertising. He was called, he called himself a space salesman. Selling advertising space for Architectural Record.
Right.
And so, yeah.
How is that? It seemed like you guys were moving around a little bit.
St. Louis. I remember, well, St. Louis was very hot and humid. I was there from first grade through third grade. And then in the third grade, we moved to Spring Lake, New Jersey. North Plainfield, New Jersey. My grandparents lived in, they retired in Spring Lake. Well, anyway, from St. Louis to North Plainfield, New Jersey for just a few months. My father was working in New York. He was progressing through the corporation. And so we were only in Plainfield, New Jersey for, I don't know, it was like 6 months. I was in the third grade. There we moved to a beautiful little town, Rowayton, Connecticut, in 1956. And that was memorable because, there was a, right after we moved there, there was a big hurricane of 1956. And it was Rowayton, Connecticut, right on Long Island Sound, just beautiful town.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I actually have family who live in Norwalk, so I've spent some time around Rowayton.
Yeah. Bailey Beach, yeah. Roten Point, and all of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's,
mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful area. Wow. And so you obviously moving around. I understand that you were young at this time, but did you notice? A large social or cultural difference moving around between major different areas of the country. Obviously, you were in the Midwest for a portion. You were in the Northeast.
Yeah.
Did you feel like there was tangible differences, socially and culturally going between these kind of places?
Well, in St. Louis, I was not totally aware of it at the time, but there was ongoing segregation. And when we moved to New Jersey, it was a very mixed school. And so that's where I learned to, accept being in school with Negroes. That back then they were called, Negroes, that was the proper term. And now I guess it's called black folks, meanwhile, that was not a problem, but part of my education that was in New Jersey. When we moved to Connecticut, there were fewer black folks, a few, but meanwhile, that was the beginning of the civil rights era, as I know it, I remember it, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Your memories?
Let's see. I remember there was a big riot in Newark years ago, and there were really mixed feelings about, I grew up in, middle-class white family, and so it was kind of a learning experience as to what was going on culturally, the differences in different parts of the country. When I moved to Westport, Connecticut, from Rowayton. Okay, so from New Jersey, where I was introduced to a little bit of black culture, had a few little black buddy friends, you know, and moved from New Jersey to Rowayton. No, there were no black folks there to speak of. But then, you know, of course, civil rights was kind of on the front burner at that point in time. And from Rowayton, let's see, I lived in Rowayton from third grade through seventh grade middle school, and moved to Westport, Connecticut, Fairfield County, and another town on Long Island Sound. And that's where, from middle school through high school, I lived there. Graduated from Staples High School in Westport in 1965. Yeah.
What exactly were you involved with, you know, in middle school, high school? Or, you know, what were kind of some things? I just to sort of paint a picture of what your life was like, you know, in high school.
Yeah. From Rowayton to Westport, I was very involved with sailing. I was on the water a lot when, you know, in the summer. I loved boating, you know, sailing. I learned to dive, a skin diver, and basics of forefront of scuba diving, Long Island Sound. So I grew up on the water, under the water. And when I was in middle school, I was always, I was trying to make money, you know. Turned out, throughout my middle school and high school, I was more concerned with getting jobs and trying to make some money. And I didn't really apply myself to my studies that much, unfortunately. But I had bicycles, I had little boats, you know, a little sailboat and my dive gear, and but I was working cutting lawns and shoveling snow and whatever, wherever I could make a buck as a kid, I was into trying to make money. My folks didn't have a lot of money at that point in time. My dad was climbing the corporate ladder, so to speak. And if I wanted anything, my dad says, well, you can go earn some money and buy what you want to buy. So, subsequently, I wasn't involved, you know, I was just an average student, you know, I didn't apply myself, unfortunately. In high school, I worked at a place called the Big Top Shop, which was a really neat setup. It was a short order cook restaurant, and I was a cook and sales, you know, counter person, and all through high school. And so that was a really quite a, it was a fairly rigorous job, actually. I was cooking and waiting and, you know, after school, all through school. And, yeah, if I wanted, you know, I bought my own clothes. I bought my own bicycle, motorcycle, car, what have you. If I wanted something, I had to earn the money for it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You know, I mean, you said you graduated in 1965.
Correct.
Can you describe, I guess, outside of, you said that, you know, the civil rights movement was occurring. What else, you know, was the political atmosphere at the time? What else was notable, you know, something you would have remembered?
Yeah.
This was
early on. Excuse me. Well, one of the jobs I had, I liked working with kids, neighborhood kids. I was a pretty responsible guy, and I got all sorts of jobs, babysitting jobs for neighbors, friends and neighbors. And, you know, I was seen as a pretty responsible young man. I was working all the time, and like I say, unfortunately, I wasn't the best student. I was just, you know, plain average C type student. And during the course of babysitting, I got a job with one family that the father was a major in the special forces, and he was had been the CO of a Nike missile site, excuse me, which was just right up the road from Staples High School, where I went to high school. So while I was a senior, well, actually a junior and senior at Staples in Westport, I periodically babysat for the kids. There were two kids, a boy and a girl, a young boy and a girl, and the wife of a Special Forces major. And at that point in time, I became a little bit aware of what was going on in Vietnam. And I had a pass to get into the Nike missile site. Well, I guess I had cleared security, I had a certain security clearance to get on this Nike missile site, and it was actually an alpha site. I didn't know what alpha meant, but the Nike missiles were actually had, my understanding later on, had atomic warheads on them. And this was part of the missile defense for the surrounding area, where, like Bridgeport, Connecticut, Norwalk, there were various Department of Defense contract companies. And so with the combination of babysitting for this family, I read some letters. I saw pictures of Vietnam and read some commentary of the Special Forces major who was up in the Highlands area. As a, you know, there was a little bit of combat going on. And so I had a vague, well, actually more than a vague understanding of what was happening in Vietnam. At that point in time, I decided, gee, I don't really want to get involved. I don't really want to go to Vietnam. And, but then it was, you know, the Cold War and communism, and of course, really when we were, remember when I was in Rowayton, Connecticut in elementary school, we had the duck and cover. We did the Lord's Prayer, the Pledge of Allegiance, and then practiced duck and cover underneath our desk. And so we were, yeah, as kids we were wondering, wow, is there going to be a nuclear bomb, or what's going on here, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And current events, we'd read, you know, we got the current events magazine, you know, a little newspaper, and we were talking about as much as we could understand so-called worldly events, things that were taking place outside of the United States. So I was interested in history at that point in time, you know, what the heck is going on? And when I started learning about Vietnam, I said, man, that's dangerous. That's a dangerous place.
Yeah.
And at the time,
at the time, did it feel, you know, was it anything, and maybe you were going to go into it, but was it anything more than, you know, just a far-off, dangerous place? Or, you know, did it seem in 1963 to 64, you know, early on, that this was something that might, you might
right.
actually be brought into?
Well, of course, in 63, yeah, it was a big deal. Everybody remembers where they were when President Kennedy was killed. And then, you know, prior to that, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis and, you know, all sorts of stuff going on between the civil rights going on and the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then Vietnam came to the forefront with, you know, President Kennedy making news, or, you know, he was in the news about Vietnam, et cetera. And then when he was killed, boy, that was a big shock to everybody. And, so, yeah, Vietnam at that point, excuse me.
Can you take me through it all, sort of, you know, when Kennedy was killed, where were you? What were your thoughts or emotions on that day?
Well, I was in high school. I was going to Staples High School at the time. And I remember when I heard that he was killed, I was actually out pheasant hunting. I was quite the, you know, duck and pheasant hunter. I actually raised the pheasants and would let them go. And at that point in time, Westport was still a lot of countryside, still had quite a bit of agriculture. And buddies of mine and I were actually pheasant hunting when I heard, I had a transistor radio. Back then it was a big deal. Everybody had a transistor radio. And I remember hearing about it over the transistor radio while I was pheasant hunting. And, you know, it was, it became actually fairly emotional. And it's, yeah, periodically, in my, one of my, I don't know if it's a problem, but I do get emotional.
No problem whatsoever.
Yeah. Okay, so that was ongoing. It was like a big vegetable soup of things swirling around, you know, between civil rights, Vietnam, politics, world events, things going on outside of the United States. Yeah, it was a pretty intense time back then. And of course, I was mainly involved with working. I worked at the Big Top Shop, and I was actually making pretty good money as a kid, you know. So, between that and out on the water, on the boat, under the water, and hunting and fishing, and I was pretty much of an outdoor kind of guy. Yeah. And also, when we were living in Connecticut is when we started going back up to Dartmouth, Hanover. And actually, we had friends that owned a beautiful 200-acre farm up on in Woodstock, Vermont, up above Dunham Hill, up above the Woodstock Inn. And wow. So, wonderful memories of actually when we started off when I was in seventh grade junior high school going up there skiing. Prior to that, back and forth, my dad was involved with the Alumni Association, and so I grew up with the understanding that I was supposed to go to Dartmouth. And being the eldest son. So wonderful memories of going up to that area, Mount Washington, the Cog Railway, and all of that. So back and forth through the course from middle school all through high school, we go up and stay at Brook Hollow Farm in Woodstock, Vermont, and from there venture forth to Dartmouth and Hanover and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that must have been wonderful. And
yeah, it was beautiful times.
Yeah, and I guess sort of that is sort of a background of your experience, you know, with Dartmouth, and, you know, I don't know, maybe some sort of expectation there, I'm not sure, but can you take me back to, you know, sort of graduation day from Westport High School, from Staples High School?
Yeah.
In 1965. I guess at this point it was, to you, you knew at this point that you weren't going to Dartmouth.
At that point in time, I knew when I graduated from high school, I was not exactly Dartmouth material. Before I graduated from high school, I thought that was when they started the community college, junior college type program. And I thought, well, I'm, you know, go to Norwalk Community College to get my grades up and use that as a springboard, figure out what the heck I'm going to do with my life or where I'm going to go from after high school. And I was well aware that I had to get my grades up to be able to go on to any type of a, more advanced college situation, college or university, get my grades up. I was planning on going to Norwalk Community College. But within 2 weeks of my graduation, my dad got transferred to California.
Oh, wow.
He was working for McGraw-Hill Publishing Company in the Sweets Catalog Division, which is construction files, et cetera.
Right.
And so he got a transfer to Los Angeles. McGraw-Hill acquired a newspaper called the Valley Green Sheet, which is a construction service newspaper in California. And so he was moved out there to become the publisher of that and integrate the Valley Green Sheet into the Sweets Catalog and McGraw-Hill Construction File type publications. And so, all of a sudden they said, well, Rick, we're moving to California. I said, wow, oh man, I've got to go. I got to go with you because I grew up listening to Beach Boys and California. Everything in California was just really cool. So I had to go. I had to be involved with that. So,
of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was exciting. So within a couple of weeks of graduating from high school, I backed off from working at the Big Top, and I was also working. I was working my butt off. I was doing landscaping. I had contracts to cut yards. I was a house painter and working at the Big Top. I was actually working my butt off and actually making pretty good money as a teenager. So California, here I come. So, back up. Draft board, the Selective Service. When you're 18, you had to register for Selective Service. Of course, when I was 16, I got a fake ID card. I got a fake a fake draft card. When you're in Connecticut, you could get your driver's license when you're 16. And drinking age in New York State was 18. And so all the kids, high school kids, it was the big deal then to get a fake draft card. There was no picture ID back then. So when I was 16, I got a fake draft card so I could go to New York State and drink beer.
Wow.
And then of course when I turned 18, boy, I'm legal now. I have a real draft card.
Yeah.
And so I had a real genuine draft card from Bridgeport, Connecticut. So I moved to.
How did it feel to hold one of those?
Excuse me?
How did it feel when you actually got the real one for yourself? Were you proud of it, or was it something?
Well, it was a.
Do with it.
Oh, once again, it was a mixed feeling because here I was 18, graduating from high school, and thought, okay, well, I'm legal to go to drink beer in New York, but still the draft, well, Vietnam was starting to cook a little bit then. And I realized, gee, no, I don't want to get drafted. And here I have this draft card. The original meeting for me was just be able to drink beer in New York. but then the realization is like, okay, I can actually get drafted unless I get into school. I need to get a 2S deferment. Back then it was called a 2S student deferment. So we moved to Chatsworth, and I got into Pierce Junior College in Woodland Hills, California. So I was a freshman. That was, what, 1965. Excuse me. So I was a matriculated student. But my first semester, I got a notice to go for a physical. And I said, yeah, okay. So I figured, you know, filling out all the student papers, et cetera, and I had a student ID. I thought, well, I have a 2S deferment. So I went for my physical, and then I promptly got my induction notice after that. And I passed the physical with flying colors.
Oh, boy.
And so I got my induction notice. I went down, you know, to the selective service place in L.A., and I said, no, hey, I'm a student. I have my papers with me. And they said, son, let me see your draft card. We want to take a look at your draft card? It says, it's Bridgeport, Connecticut. Do you realize you're living in California? I thought I technically checked in just being a student, but I hadn't physically gone to register, re-register, transfer from Connecticut Selective Service to California Selective Service. And they said, well, you have 6 weeks to get your stuff together before you're getting inducted into the Army. Yeah. So that was a rude awakening. I thought, well, gee whiz, okay, maybe I can use this to my advantage. I grew up on boats, and I was a good sailor, and so I thought, well, I'm going to go and join the Coast Guard so I can guard a yacht club or something. So I had a short period of time to get my stuff together before I had to get, you know, go into the Army, and I said, no, I'm not going to go to Vietnam. I don't want to go in the Army. I don't want to get drafted. So I looked around, and I couldn't get into the Coast Guard unless I signed up for like 6 years or something. I thought, well, I get a military obligation out of the way and then be able to go back to school and the GI Bill, et cetera. Well, North Hollywood Naval Training Center, it was Naval Reserve Training Center, I drove by there a few times, so I just, my car automatically pulled into the drive, into the parking lot there. And I went in and said, hey, what's it like joining the Naval Reserve? What do I have to do? And, you know, I don't want to go to Vietnam. I don't want to get drafted in the Army, but, you know, I'm looking around. I really like to join the Coast Guard, but what do you guys have to offer? What can I do? And I said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, it's kind of what I don't want to do. I don't want to go to Vietnam. If I join the Naval Reserve for 2 years, do I have to go to Vietnam? So I'll never forget, he was a yeoman, first class vintner, said, well, son, no, we're not sending 2 year reservists to Vietnam. And I had a friend who was a corpsman, Navy hospital corpsman, on aircraft carrier, the Wasp, who was based out of Naples, Italy. And this guy was having a great time traveling all around Europe, and boy, what an education that was. And he'd graduated from high school a couple of years prior to me. So anyway, and then I'd had life-saving Red Cross stuff, and my grandfather was a doctor, my grandmother was his nurse anesthetist, so I had vague understanding of various medical things, first aid and what have you. So I thought, well, yeah, I'll be a corpsman. If I become a corpsman, can I do my military obligation in a hospital or maybe on a ship, you know, and Navy hospital? And I said, yeah, great, good idea. We need corpsmen. So I tested out, went through the various batteries to test and did well on it. And I said, yeah, well, Okay. Raise your right hand. I swore me in. And I was a 2-year naval recruit, and I said, well, if I go to boot camp and all that, and so I let my folks know. I said, well, I'm in the Navy now. But I grew up with the notion of duty, honor, country. My dad was an illustrious World War II T-47 Army Air Corps fighter pilot. And so I grew up with all his stories and various situations. And so,
I guess you felt this duty on honor and country. Did you feel that that was reason enough to go and serve over in Vietnam, or did you have any views about the war itself? Or did you feel like, regardless, it's my job, my duty to serve for my country? Did you have any sort of feelings towards the war?
I had a specific obligation, my inner conversation and feeling of duty on our country, and that, yeah, I should do the honorable thing. I should fulfill my military obligation without going to Vietnam. And so thinking, well, I can, work in a hospital or, be helping people rather than hurting them and avoid getting hurt or killed.
Sort of contextualize this within our conversation here. When you took this oath to be a two-year Navy Reserve Corpsman, is this like the fall of 1965, or is this the
66? It was 66, yes.
Okay.
And so, wait a minute. No, actually, yeah, I did join. Heck. It was, 65, 66. I can't remember the specific date that I actually joined, but I said, well, of course, I went to, down to, San Diego Naval Recruit Training Center, and I was in the class of 669, 1966, yeah. Class 669 at the San Diego Naval Recruit Training Center. So yeah, I went down there and just ate it up. I had a great time. I really actually enjoyed, I had a certain amount of self-discipline and, feeling of obligation of doing my duty. And, so yeah, I became a master at arms of the company and I, class 669. And I just ate it up. I loved the training. And,
can you take me through, maybe a given day of what training would look like for you? I guess sort of, from when you get out of bed in the morning to that night, what did it look like?
Yeah, rise and shine at, about 5 o'clock in the morning, all the typical recruit stuff going on, with the DI screaming at you. So I just sucked it up. And my dad gave me a few pointers. There's the right way, the wrong way, and the military way. And you better say, yes, sir, no, sir, no excuse, sir. So, meanwhile, I prided myself in being somewhat squared away, so to speak. When I graduated, was actually the meritorious recruit of that company. And I received an award as a captain's mast for being the meritorious recruit of my company, and it was a great honor. Yeah, I felt, boy, I'm really accomplishing something here.
And for your company that you were with, how many other corpsmen were there? Were you, like, you know, surrounded by
all of them? Well, this was basic training, so. Basic training. So there was one or two other guys that thought about, you know, wanting to be a corpsman, but at that point in time, you weren't really accepted to go to the A school until you completed the basic training. And so then I graduated being the so-called meritorious recruit for company 669. And so after graduation, went back to Chatsworth to stay with my folks because I was slated to go A school at Balboa Naval Hospital, but a month later. And, you know, it was rotating class, what have you. So, went back, stayed with my folks a little bit for a little while before I had to report to Balboa Naval Hospital, which was the Class A school for the beginning of Navy Hospital Corpsman training. And, of course, at that point in time, I was a two-year reservist. So the clock, I thought the clock started ticking when I was in basic training as towards the two-year program obligation. Well, anyway, so I went through Balboa, you know, Corpsman Class A school, Navy Hospital Corpsman training at Balboa Naval Hospital. And I loved it. Once again, I ate it up. I did really, really well. I was a 4-0 sailor and really enjoyed the training. And I felt, man, you know, I am learning all sorts of neat stuff. And I'm fulfilling my military obligation, and I'll be able to go on and work in a hospital someplace, wherever, maybe on board ship, I don't know. I was along for the ride, and I felt as though I was doing fairly well at that point in time. So after I went through the Class A training at Balboa, I did really well. And, so they sent me up to Oakland Naval Hospital.
And what kind of patients, sorry to interject there, what type of patients were you seeing, and who were you working alongside when you were doing this training at Balboa?
At Balboa, we had, it was a whole mixture of things, you know, a lot of, you know, basic first aid, advanced first aid, stabilization of wounds, just being more or less, it was actually paralleled what a licensed practical nurse has to go through. And so all the training it was pretty much all the training that a licensed practical nurse has to go through. Anatomy, physiology, biology, and pharmacology. It was very intense.
Yeah.
And learning basic, you know, we visit the ER, emergency room, operating room procedures, just everything. It was a smattering of everything that went on in a naval hospital.
Do you have any specific memories of, you know, a given patient or something that, you know, left an impact on you, a memory from that?
At Balboa, there was no real any one outstanding situation. It was very intense training. Let's see. I remember, well, there was a lieutenant commander nurse and a chief petty officer, corpsman. And when we graduated, of course, the chief corpsman had been through Korea. I don't know. He didn't say if he had been involved with Vietnam or not. But I remember that when we graduated from the Corps school, the nurse and the chief became very emotional. And word got around that, well, the guys that were excluding me being a reservist, a lot of these guys were going to go on to Vietnam and then go on to train with the Marine Corps. Well, and it was understood that, some would make it and some would not. Vietnam was a dangerous place. At that point in time, I didn't think, well, gee, I'm a lucky guy. I don't have to go to Vietnam. So I remember the nurse being very emotional and the chief being very emotional. In respect to, they didn't come right out and say, well, you know, some of you aren't going to make it back home. But there was kind of that, feeling, kind of an atmosphere whereby, you know, some of these guys are going to go right and start training with the Marine Corps. So I got lucky. I was transferred to, Oakland Naval Hospital working on a neurosurgery ward. Captain Clark was the commanding officer of the neuro. He was the head neurosurgeon there at Oakland Naval Hospital. And so I really had to be squared away working on a neurosurgery ward. You know, everything had to be 4-0. And, yeah.
Yeah, no, so I guess just getting back to where we were. Yeah, as I was saying that, you know, I'm sure the neurosurgery ward would have been an incredibly delicate operation there. And it was, I'm sure everything had to be exact, as you were saying. And I guess, to continue from there.
Well, working on the neurosurgery ward became very depressing because it was working with quadriplegics, paraplegics, you know, working pre-op, post-op. Well, man. These are guys coming back from Vietnam, mainly Marines, all sorts of head wounds, spinal wounds, you know, neurosurgery type wounds. And boy, was that a shocker, to see just really incredibly vicious wounds on these guys. And then hearing their stories about combat. Marine Corps combat. And these guys were hardcore Marine Corps combat troopers. And, it was breathtaking to hear some of the stories and what happened and what was going on. And, of course, then Liberty had to go off to, San Francisco and, you know, clear the air and try to maintain a sense of, get away from, man, it was just very, very depressing working on a neurosurgery ward. And a few people, you know, a few of the patients died.
Sort of a part two here. We unfortunately broke up a little bit, but picking up from where we were, we're talking about your work in Oakland treating, you know, on the neurosurgery ward, treating
right.
Marine Corps veterans who are returning from Vietnam who had some pretty serious injuries, some trauma. Just picking up from there.
So, working on the neurosurgery ward was very, very educational. I was working under Captain Clark, who was the commanding officer. And then, various nurses. Remember, Lieutenant Commander Heath was the charge nurse. And so it was, pre-op, post-op patient care. you know, working with striker frames and IVs and catheterization and bird respirators and medication. Right. Yeah. And, yes.
It seems like it was, sort of a baptism by fire. I mean, it was sort of a much different world and picture than you, had seen previously at Balboa?
Very much so. Very much so. We didn't have, at Balboa, I didn't have direct contact with seriously wounded veterans coming back from Vietnam at that point in time. It was more, as a matter of fact, we didn't have any experience working with gravely, seriously wounded Vietnam veterans coming back. It was just a smattering of overall naval hospital routine, et cetera. But up at Oakland, man, it was up close and personal. And listening to, a lot of it was of talking things out, learning what happened to the individuals. What was actually going on? Not that I want to talk about, once again, it gets too emotional.
Yeah, I understand.
These were seriously wounded, and a lot of them weren't going to make it.
Right.
And, yeah. Woo.
Yeah.
So.
If you need a moment, let me know.
No, I'm okay. Like I say, it just became very depressing. And working next to the neuropsychiatric ward, at that point in time, they were talking about what they called about combat trauma neuroses, which I guess it was the forerunner of PTSD. But I realized that they were treating career NCOs, career officers, who were actually having psychological problems as a result of their traumatic experiences in Vietnam.
Right.
And, of course, the guys that were on the neurosurgery ward, they were having their own issues, of course. And there was kind of a little bit of a transference went on there with me. Absorbing
that.
Yeah. What you call a transference thing going on.
And
yes. What?
Well, and sort of, when you were seeing all these people, did this change, sort of seeing their outlook on what Vietnam was to them at the time, did this sort of, even develop your perspective of what was going on over there and the work that was being done and the sort of conflict itself?
Well, at that point in time, I actually developed kind of a hatred towards the enemy to see what these guys went through. And not that I wanted to become involved with Vietnam, but without realizing it, I was at that point in time. And listening to them about being in combat and incredibly intense situations. Couldn't help but put myself in their shoes, so to speak. Not that any of them could even walk again. Talk about putting them. I couldn't put myself in their shoes because a lot of them couldn't even wear shoes. A lot of them were bilateral amputees, and, it was a combination, just not neurological, but amputations and everything.
Right.
And, so I along with feelings of depression, I developed a feeling of anger as to what happened to these guys, how it happened. and I started developing a certain emotional feeling of anger towards the enemy, towards the Viet Cong, specifically the North Vietnamese. At that point in time, I developed a feeling of anger towards the North Vietnamese, not that I wanted to go over there and jump into it myself.
Right. And
so, yes, what?
The North Vietnamese, even more so than soldiers who were South Vietnamese.
Well, my understanding, awareness at that point in time was that the North Vietnamese guys were just really hardcore compared to the South Viet Cong. The hardcore North Vietnamese were diehard. My understanding at that point in time was they were diehard communists. And, I had the notion that it was a civil war going on there. And the North were really, really aggressive.
Yeah.
And, so meanwhile, I made the mistake of fraternizing with a Lieutenant JG, and I started dating a Navy nurse, which was a big no-no. I was enlisted. I was an enlisted person, and Lieutenant JG was an officer. So the charge nurse didn't appreciate that. And she let me know whether or not they were going to transfer me to Marine Corps or something. You know, they don't really tell you exactly what's going on, what you're going to go through, other than, you know, working there now, here and now, and at the moment as to what's going on. I didn't know what the military had what they really wanted to do with me, but I think I was actually being trained to go with the Marine Corps at that point in time, but I didn't realize it at that point in time. When I was discovered, I was dating the Lieutenant JG, the charge nurse said, well, Crabtree, you're being transferred to the Marine Corps. As a fleet Marine Corps. You're being transferred to the Fleet Marine Corps.
Oh, my gosh. And when was this?
That was in 67. Specific month, I don't know. I can't remember the specific month.
No worries. Where did you go from there? What did that mean for you?
From Oakland Naval Hospital, I was transferred down to Camp Del Mar. It was part of the, Camp Pendleton Marine Corps training. It was called Field Medical Service School. At Camp Del Mar, which was actually part of Camp Pendleton Marine Corps training. So went through Field Medical Service School, which was dealing with training for combat, as to what you have to do as a frontline combat Navy corpsman. And I still didn't think I would necessarily have to go to Vietnam.
It wasn't on your mind necessarily. You didn't think it was
still
a guarantee.
I was still kind of naive as to how everything works with the military. And at that point in time, Field Medical Service School, it was, once again, fantastic training. It was actually a relief to get away from working on the neurosurgery unit. Because now I'm down working with Marines, being trained by Marines, and it was next to the Marine recon training area.
And what did training there look like? Were you seeing, was this more, tending towards first aid?
Yeah, all of the above.
We weren't working. More like you were getting ready for war rather than just to treat patients they were treating.
At that point in time, not working with any casualties coming back from Vietnam. Yeah. We weren't, there was no hands-on working with casualties at that point in time. It was like a crash course, Marine boot camp crash course, with all the discipline that went along with it. Physical, you know, all the PT, physical therapy, the marching, the calisthenics. It was very, very physical. Very demanding physically.
Yeah.
And, well, learning more as the hands-on as to actual equipment that was used in the field, you know, over in Vietnam in a combat scenario. And it entailed going through, you know, they had mock-up villages and different exercises and things. And once again, it became very intense physically and psychologically, picking up on, you know, we had to carry weapons with us all the time, go through the referees. We had to learn, of course, the basic training, Navy basic training, we learned how to use small arms. But here it was very intense use of all sorts of, you know, pistols, rifles, shotguns, including 30 caliber, 50 caliber machine guns. Just
and
basic.
And this was so different for you as a corpsman than it would have been for any other, you know, discipline, Matt. Was it?
Say again?
Was this any different for you, you know, this weapons training and sort of, and yeah, I'm sure that must have been an interesting process for you, being trained how to use weapons of, like, you know, offensive assault kind of things, when all of your previous training had been mostly just, you know, medical and treatment wise. Was that a strange
right.
feeling for you?
Well, once again, but it was mainly in a defensive posture. Theoretically, we were considered non-combatants. And, but when you're with the Marines, you had to be versatile. And, so I grew up with, you know, hunting and fishing. I had rifles and shotguns and different things, 22 shotguns and different things. I learned the basics of handling a pistol when I was a teenager. So I had a familiarity with small arms and weapons, and you know, I knew basic field craft because we did a lot of camping, and I learned orienteering and, you know, how to use a map and compass and all that. So I was, once again, I went to it. I got to it. And, once again, I was a 4-0 kind of guy. I just immersed myself into it. It was very physical, but, and I enjoyed the training. I enjoyed working with the weapons and enjoyed, learning all about how to operate in the field in a combat situation. And at that point in time, even though I didn't really want to go to Vietnam, I was psychologically, like I say, I had a little hatred towards the anger towards the North Vietnamese and what they had done to guys that I'd worked with on the neurosurgery ridge. And so slowly but surely, I guess I was being aimed towards going to Vietnam. And, but I still, well, when I finished field medical service school, I theoretically only had 8 months left towards my 2-year obligation, active duty. But then the realization of, no, I don't have 8 months left. I was extended. My military, active duty military obligation was extended. And they stated that, well, initial boot camp, Naval Reserve training, you know, my boot camp didn't count towards active
really?
Duty.
Did you feel like, you know, was this sort of a slap in the face? Was it, you know, was this a surprise to you?
I can't say, at that point in time, I can't say it was a slap in the face. Now I look at it as that, but At that point in time, I just kind of rolled with it. I thought, gee whiz, you know, gee, that's the way it works, you know.
Yeah.
like I say, I was still a little bit naive at exactly how the military, all the ins and outs and the technicalities and all that. And so, yeah, I got the, all of a sudden, the rude awakening. Oh, I don't have 8 months left. I've got a year and a half left, something like that. And
yeah.
So there was a point in time when I had that rude awakening within 5 days, I was in Vietnam.
Really? So it was that soon. I mean, they said, okay, you're done and now you're ready to go, or was this, was there any time?
Well,
field medical service school?
Yeah, I finished the field medical service school, and then I was attached to a Marine Corps company at Camp Pendleton.
Do you remember the company?
It was actually the service, you know, like H&S Service Company. It's written down someplace. I can't remember specifically the specific designation, but it was all corpsmen. And we were at a dispensary. It was at, Las Pulgas area in Camp Pendleton. And it was just all corpsmen, field medical service, guys had all gone through the recent training. And that's when I realized that I didn't have just 8 months left. And I was just there for a brief period of time when I got, like, my orders on, Friday. I went home. My folks were living in L.A. I went home for the weekend. And Monday I had to report to Travis. What was it? Before Travis Air Force Base.
Do you remember when this was?
It was March of 67.
Right. And did you fly over, or were they still taking ships over at this point?
No, it went to report to, it was bussed up to Travis Air Force Base. We flew from Travis, actually on Continental Airlines.
Really?
Contract civilian. And it was a whole combination. It wasn't just corpsmen. It was, you know, Marine Corps, Navy. It was a whole combination. I guess there were some Army guys, what have you. Just a 707 plane full of guys that we stopped in Hawaii briefly. And then transported to Okinawa. And I was in Okinawa for just a couple of days. And then from Okinawa, flew commercial, I believe it. Yeah, it was Continental Airlines, flew us to Da Nang Airfield. And so within 5 days of getting my orders to Nam, I was out in the jungle. I was out in the bush. And they sent me to, from Da Nang, I was assigned to Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 7th Marine Regiment, 1st Marine Division. And they flew me down to a place called Duck Fo on Operation DeSoto. And that was in March of 67. And wow. Talk about a rude awakening. I got down there and I was issued an M14 rifle and what's called a Unit 1, just basic corpsman first aid. They call it a Unit 1 first aid bag. But luckily, I smuggled over with me a Browning high power 9mm pistol with a bunch of magazines.
Wow.
Which is, yeah. When I found out I was going to have to go to Vietnam, I learned all about weapons and different things, what worked, what didn't work. And, one of the troopers, one of the Marine Corps sergeant said, "Doc, you gotta go get yourself a Browning high power pistol, 9mm, and it carried 13 rounds. And I said, "It's a very reliable weapon, very accurate, much better than a 45. Because all the corpsmen were issued 45s, but I was, because I had my own pistol, I was issued an M14 at that point in time. And we got down to Duck Foe, and I had, all my gear with me, and talk about a rude awakening, a brand new guy, new guy, they call it FNGs. And I was an FNG, and standing in a chow line with all my stuff, I put my sea bag, they assigned me a bunker. So I stashed all my stuff in the bunker, and I was standing in a chow line, and there was fighting ongoing. You could hear gunfire and fighting going on in the distance. And I said, "Boy, man, here I am. This is for real. This is actually happening. This is actually happening. I'm really in Vietnam." And it was the first time I heard gunfire, planes and helicopters and machine guns and artillery and all that. And talk about the awakening realization of this is happening. I'm here. And this is for real. And standing in a chow line, and a couple of guys that are called, short timers, crusty Marines. They were showing off, and I think they had a little bit too much of Carling Black Label, whatever. So they were showing off, these two salty Marines who were ready to rotate back. They were showing off and playing quick draw.
Oh,
for these new guys standing in line. And guy forgot to clear his 45. And standing there about 10 feet away from me, I saw a Marine blow another Marine away with a 45. And it went through, killed the first Marine. The guy shot. The Marine died right away. Bang. Bullet went through him and paralyzed the guy behind him. And I said, "My God, this is like the first hour I was there." And I couldn't believe it. Well, talk about a shock. They were just playing quick draw, and one guy blew another guy away, his buddy, killed him right there. 45 went through, one guy killed a guy, and then it hit another guy and paralyzed him behind him. And I said, "Oh, unbelievable." So I couldn't do anything for the guy who was dead, and did what I could for, stabilize the guy that got hit. And,
was that your first, experience really, truly is, you were the guy there, right, as a corpsman, to probably one of the first people to treat.
It happened right there in front of me. I couldn't believe it. And so then I tossed my cookies. I puked. I got nauseated. I threw up. I couldn't believe it. And here I'm sitting on the side. They're still kind of on the sideline, on the chow line. There's a field kitchen there. And I'm sitting there, after I puked and trying to figure out, man, what is going on here? And then all of a sudden there was a huge explosion about 25, 30 feet away, a bunker. it was a hot day, and then three Marines inside a bunker, a Laws rocket went off. For whatever reason, this thing went off, and it killed three guys. I went running up. I said, "Corman up, Corman up." I went running up, and it was just three guys all blown to pieces. That was in the first hour I was there. And I thought, my God, how am I going to live through this?
Yeah.
Here there were four guys dead right away, just without even being in combat, within the first hour I was there.
Yeah.
And what a mess. What a mess.
Did you, you know, I know you said before that you had such strong feelings, you know, against the, you know, the North Vietnamese as an enemy.
Yeah.
Did this help change your perspective? Did this make you just hate the war more broadly in general?
No. I just had, at that point in time, I got the shakes. I was so scared. It was just total fear of what I was going to be in, what was going to happen, you know. Where do I go from here? Of course, I was going to have to go out in the bush. So it was like, okay, I had a 5-day indoctrination as to what was going on in Duck Pho, Operation DeSoto. And I literally just had to screw up my guts. And, you know, being really, you know, so many emotions going through my head at that point in time. It literally made my head swim. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
My head was swimming on top of a whole bunch of fear. I was just scared shitless. And,
was there anything sort of grounding or, you know, something that helped you to get through those, you know, first few days that helped, you know, to steal yourself?
I had a few mementos. I smoked a pipe at that point in time, and I brought a few tobacco pipes with me, and I had a cross, Christian cross, and I had a silver, for whatever reason, I put a sterling silver 4-leaf clover in my right boot, in the sole of my boot. And so I just concentrated on smoking my pipe. Kind of, you know, smoke my pipe. Felt the Christian cross. And I kept my pistol really close to me. And I thought, here I go, man. This is for real. And I don't know if I'm going to make it out of here. So I kept saying the Lord's Prayer over and over again. And I prepared myself to die as best I could, just being scared shitless. And so then 5 days later, I had to go out on a patrol. And it was a bad place. And there were bunkers around, spider holes. These guys were all dug in. Viet Cong, North Vietnamese. This place was swarming, that whole area just swarming with North Vietnamese and Viet Cong. They were dug in tunnels and spider holes and all this stuff. So we had to go out and patrol. And start off with the M14s, which worked well for the Marines. And they were heavier, you know. It was like 2 weeks before we got our first M16s. We went out on patrol, and off in the distance, we'd hear a bell ringing. Dong, 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 dong. And it was like, for whom the bell tolled. And what it was there's way off in the distance, there was an old French church. And we called them the bell ringer. As soon as a patrol left the compound, there was a signal from the bell ringer. And the guys there said, yep, within a certain amount of time, we're going to have contact. Something's going to happen.
This was a warning bell that the Vietnamese troops were signaling.
Yeah.
They knew that you were out. Is that what it was, usually?
Yeah. Signaling that there was a patrol headed towards wherever, going out, leaving the compound. So within a short period of time, there was an inevitable, you know, guys that pop up out of the spider holes. And, you know, it was very strange situation. And I realized, man, these people really want to kill us. And it's like, okay, how am I going to survive this? So I thought, I did what I could, just to keep my courage and screw up my guts and just think, well, okay, if it happens, I hope it happens quick, and I'm not going to end up like any of these guys on the neurosurgery here. If I got a slight wound, you know, okay, that's one thing. But to have be seriously wounded, I would have just rather been killed right away.
Yeah.
And so I prepared myself to either, you know, get either a, I didn't know what kind of a slight wound I'd get to be medevaced out of there, or just outright get killed. And I wasn't suicidal, but I got to the point where I became very fatalistic. And I thought, well, if it happens, it happens. But I was saying my own prayers at that point in time. And what
were you able to, you know, form any friendships, or, you know, how was the social dynamic between you and, the fellow people in your unit, that you were going out on these, you know, sharing this experience with?
Well, I was kind of, well, trained and informed not to make real close friendships. And so I had to maintain a certain emotional insulate myself emotionally, which actually now thinking about it, I'm starting to insulate myself emotionally again. But so we go out daytime patrol, nighttime ambush, and then a couple of weeks after being there, they took the M14s away, which were functional, and they gave us the first piece of crap, M16.
Yeah.
And there were really bad problems with that thing jamming. And the Marines were trained, you know, you ate, slept, drank, your rifle is your best friend. The rifle is going to keep you alive.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, when we got the first M16, we couldn't press those things because they jam up. There were a whole bunch of problems with them. The wrong kind of powder in the ammunition. It's like anybody who's served in Vietnam combat knows the story behind the dysfunctional, the first dysfunctional M16s. And that ended up getting a lot of people killed and wounded. Because you'd be in the middle of a firefight, you shoot off one magazine, and as soon as the barrel heated up, it would literally cement the brass cartridge to the chamber wall. And even if you had a cleaning kit, you just knocked the back of the brass out. They were rendered completely dysfunctional. And then talk about building up a hatred. We couldn't trust their weapons. And
was there a hatred or ill will towards, you know, those who were distributing them? Like, was there a feeling that, you know, somehow the conspirators who were, you know, distributing these weapons weren't looking out for you guys?
Yeah, we were wondering what the hell's going on. Of course, we, you know, the Marines heard that we got the low end of the grab bag. But I'll tell you what, at that point in time, there was one gunny sergeant. There was a World War II and Korean veteran, Gunny Miller. He was our platoon commander. And he said, "We've lost the war already. We were outgunned." He said, "We were outgunned. The AK-47s, the SKSs, and their B-40 rockets, the RPG rockets. We were outgunned. Our weapons didn't work." And the Viet Cong, the bad guys, knew it. And boy, did they try to take advantage of it. I hate those things to today. You talk about black guns, black weapons, so-called. Well, I'm not an anti-gunner by any means. I grew up hunting and fishing. I'm a sportsman and still hunt and fish, whatever. But I developed a hatred for that M16. I hate it to today.
Yeah.
Yeah,
thank you for sharing, obviously, even up to this point. It's incredibly powerful to be hearing.
I was not there. I was not there to hurt people. I was there to help them. And I was told that, you know, okay, you have to treat, after you treat your own troops, you have to, you know, there's a wounded enemy. I was obligated to treat everybody that was wounded or what have you. And I had to treat, I treated VC later, you know, afterwards, keep them alive so I get some information on them. But anyway, I'm not an anti-gunner, and I'm not, you know, I'm not into, I was there to help people, not hurt them. And there's a fine line between defense and offense. But if I didn't have that Browning high power pistol with me, I wouldn't be talking to you now. And saved my butt a few times. Because all these guys, the weapons were jamming and they called corpsmen up. I had to go. Somebody was wounded in the middle of combat, whatever. And yeah, one introductory when I was there, a couple of days later, you know, when I went out on my first patrol, there was a sergeant. I won't mention his name, E5 Sergeant. He said, "Doc, listen, we have a 3-strike rule here. If we call Carmen up, you better get your ass up here. You better perform. If you screw up 3 times, if the VC don't kill you, I will."
Wow.
How about that for an introduction?
Right.
This E5 Corps, E5 Sergeant said, "Doc, we got the three-strike rule. If we call you and screw up three times, if the VC don't kill you, I will. I said, well, you know, that can be a two-way street, Sergeant. I said, what goes around? I said, what goes around, does it come around too?
Yeah,
at that point in time, yes, what?
Well, yeah, no, it's very interesting to hear that, you know, you hear sometimes these stories, you know, medical professionals and those who are treating people as if, you know, you never caused the injury or the illness or whatever is occurring to them. But obviously there comes, you know, with the treatment, a certain onus of, you know, what is it, my, is something, you know, to do with me if it doesn't go well. I mean, but obviously that's not fair to you. And that must have been incredibly difficult to have this, because all you were doing was trying to help. So I'm sure that was very difficult.
Yeah, I knew I had a very responsible job to do. I was scared shitless, but then I got to the point where I got tired of being scared. And I overcome the fear with anger.
Was there a moment when this happened, or was this over time?
Well, actually, it was kind of a staccato experience. You know, there are times when wounded guys, you know, there's different scenarios, daytime patrol, nighttime ambush, stuff happened at night too. A lot of stuff happened at night. And my anger, well, helped me survive. It wasn't like I had this. I just had, at that point in time, I had anger against the war. I had anger against the enemy, but I had anger. I can't say that I had anger against the United States of America, but I developed an anger over the immediate situation as to where I was, time and place, and what was going on. I just, I thought to overcome my fear and anxiety, I just got angry.
Yeah.
And not to the point where I was like killed crazy or anything like that. That happened to some of the Marines. Some of them literally get killed crazy.
Yeah.
But I just thought, okay, like playing a contact sport. If you're going to get hit, the best defense is a good offense.
Yeah.
And, you know, before you get hit, hit them hard, hit as hard as you can, and then, you know, just do what you can to get through it.
Yeah.
And
so
what?
No, carry on. Sorry.
So when you get to that point where life and death, and you're going out and you think you can get it anytime, anything can happen at any time.
Right.
You just gotta, you can't totally explain it, but you just have to screw up your guts and, get angry.
Was, do you have any particularly, you know, not like a good memory, but like a memory in which you really felt that the work you were doing was validated, and that you were able to really help, you know, fix something or be, have a really positive impact on someone? I don't know if there's a story or anything, because you obviously, day in, day out, that's the work that you were doing, you know, on the larger extent.
If we're out in the boondocks, so to speak, in the bush, whatever, it was like anything could happen anytime. But if we got into an actual village, there was a certain sense of, okay, if there's civilians around and, you know, villagers around, there's less likely to be a firefight in the middle of a village. And so part of my job, I learned, I like kids. You know, when I was back as a civilian in Westport, I had jobs babysitting for kids. I was really good with kids. And so I turned into kind of a candy man. I carried hard candies with me and soap. And I'd go to these villages, and part of the indoctrination is we were there to so-called win the hearts and minds. Now, mind you, these are VC villages. There were no friendlies living there. But kids are kids, and I'd go in, there'd be swarms of kids, and I'd help the kids. And then word got around that I was good with kids, that I would take care of swarms of kids, give them hard candies and soaps and toothbrushes, toothpaste, and clean up their infections. And I carried a lot of Fizax with me. I went through gallons of Fizax. And I figured, okay, one of my survival techniques is I want these people to like me, not hate me. And so part of my survival technique is to make friends with hundreds of kids. And from village to village, I'd take care of swarms of kids. And so that made me feel good, taking care of kids. And at the same time, I started thinking, these people don't want to see me get killed. Now, this was mainly after we left Duck Flow. Duck Flow was just a plain-ass bad, bad place. Nobody there liked us. But after Operation DeSoto, about, what was it, a month, 6 weeks after getting there, we got transferred back up to the Dai Lok area, Quang Nam province. It was 35, 40 miles southwest of Da Nang. And that's when they decided, whoever they is, who also coordinated with Special Forces guys. And so I turned into a candy man who would go from village to village, and I'd carry hard candies with me and soap and clean up. We'd go into these villages and swarms of kids from village to village, they knew I was coming. So I took care of lots and lots of kids. And I got the feeling, you know, even the old men and the little old ladies, there were no men of military age in these villages. We were out in what was called Indian country. And these were all based. Indian country means we're out in the Badlands, you know, it's all VC territory.
Yeah.
VC territory, VC villages. There were all these villages,
is the men. Is there a marked change in your experience? I mean, also, for how long were you in Duk Phu?
How long is what?
How long were you in Duk Phu, correct, that you were in initially?
Well, Duk Phu, yeah, it was there. We were only there, I think it was not quite 2 months.
Okay, and then was there then a big, was it a market change in, you know, your feeling of your experience when you went to Dai Lok?
This is the same area. This is the same area that Lieutenant William Smoyer, Dartmouth graduate, got killed.
In Dai Lok.
In Dai Lok area, yeah, in Quang Nam province, but 35, 40 miles southwest of Da Nang, and Of course, Moyer was killed after I left, but this is the area that, okay, and that's to be talked about later, but, no, I go from village to village taking care of these kids, and now kids are kids, and all the kids have secrets. And these kids would tell me where the booby traps were, where not to go. You know, we weren't there to get their brothers and their fathers. I realized, and sometimes I'd work with a special forces guy to get information. And we realized these kids did not like the North Vietnamese. The North Vietnamese hardcore would come in, push them around, take their food. You know, they were hardcore communists. Now, these villagers were mainly Buddhists, and they were spiritual people. And I'm not supposed to talk about some of it, but, you know, whereby I go and kids have secrets, and periodically a guy who was a linguist was with me, and he was acting like my assistant. But he understood everything that they were saying. And this guy dressed as a Lance Corporal. He was really special forces guy. Now, I was sworn to not talk about this, but the, you know, statute of, I don't know, what is it? Letter of non-disclosure or what have you. That's long past. This is, you know, ancient history now, but at the time... At the time, I was told if the locals figure out that we're really getting information, we're dead ducks. And anyway, it was another part of survival whereby these kids didn't want to see me get hit or get hurt. And I go from village to village and then get information from them. Take care of swarms of them, took care of them. Clean them up. Meanwhile, the little old ladies watching us, they're all carrying cane, these big cane knives, watching every move I made, and there'd always be at least two of them chewing their betel nut and have the big cane knives ready to descend on me like Benihana if I got out of line.
Were they protective of their kids? Is that what it was?
Well, of course they were protective.
Right.
But then I'd help out the little old ladies too, you know, and try to make friends with them. But of course most of the time just seeing, you know, you can tell somebody looking at you and they really don't like you. They don't have to say anything. Just their, demeanor. You can read it in their eyes. You read it in their eyes.
And you said that the kids, at least, weren't necessarily fond of the North Vietnamese either. Do you feel like if the adults, you know, they had a similar feeling where they didn't like North Vietnamese, but they also didn't like your presence as well, but they were somehow stuck between the two forces?
The kids were caught in a squeeze play. They're all caught in a squeeze play. So nobody liked killing. Nobody really liked fighting. You know, the kids certainly, you know, they didn't want to be involved with the fighting or the killing or booby traps. So the kids knew where the booby traps were, which was the main thing. I was really trying to figure out. They'd tell me, oh, you don't go here, you don't go there, whatever. So that was really, I think that's one reason why I made it through too, is because swarms of little kids didn't want to see me get hurt or killed. And then periodically we could see that I didn't really leave anything that the enemy could use, you know, toothbrushes, toothpaste, toothbrushes, bars of soap, like motel bars of soap, hard candy. But their fathers and older brothers, I think, appreciated what I did. And there were times if Marines, if guys got really belligerent, if they're pushing people around or got a little too rough or out of hand or did something, the Vietnamese could get very selective. You know, they keep an eye, they're keeping an eye on us all the time. And yeah. if they didn't like somebody, that person wouldn't last long. You know what I mean? It got a little bit
scary. Targeting certain people if, you know, they felt that they weren't treating the Vietnamese correct well.
Yeah, if they got, it didn't happen all the time, but luckily the unit I was with, we didn't get involved with any kind of an atrocity situation, but there were times when some civilians got, you know, well, a lot happened at night. Most of the stuff happened at night, and we'd be out daytime patrol, nighttime ambush. We'd figure out. When we were walking around during the day, we'd figure out where we were going to set up at night. And certain situations where we would set up in what was called, you know, literally free fire zones. So anybody walking around at night out in wherever we'd set up, those people knew that they weren't. It's controversial, but here it is. Part of the free fire zones, anything moving at night was fair game, and I guess we were fair game for them also. It was a two-way street in that regard. And,
yeah.
So there were times when we'd be out and at night in certain areas where we wanted to just kind of take it easy. We didn't want to get into the conflict at night. You know, because it was just really nasty, nasty to be in a firefight at night. You know, it's nasty during the day, but it's even more nasty at night.
Yeah.
So there were times when we didn't want to, obviously, you know. let me put it this way. We go into, there are Buddhist cemeteries all over the place. And so if we didn't, it was kind of an unwritten rule, I think. We'd go and spend a night inside a Buddhist cemetery and keep the place clean. If we were on their sacred territory inside a Buddhist cemetery, we didn't have to worry about getting shot at and, grenade, you know, didn't have to worry about grenades or explode, being shot at much. It was just like a little oasis, so to speak, at night. And we could kind of sort of relax if we were inside a Buddhist cemetery. And I spent a few nights, more than a few nights, curled up. The Buddhist graves are symbolic of a woman's womb. And circular with a round hump in the middle of it and with the uterus pointing east. So they figured that, okay, afterlife, you know, the Buddhists believed in an afterlife. And believe it or not, there were, I don't know, the spirit world was active in those cemeteries. And so I made peace. I tried to make peace with the spirits in those cemeteries. And I let the spirits know that I was not there to hurt people. Unless, you know, I'll admit, I don't know, you know, if I was being shot at or in the middle of whatever, you know, they talk about the fog, not necessarily the fog of war, but there's the chaos of war. And in the middle of the chaos, sometimes I had to defend myself. You know, if somebody was trying to shoot me, my Browning high power helped out. I didn't carry a long gun with me most of the time. But, it's controversial, you know, who knows, who believes in the spirit world? I made friends with the spirits as best I could. And these were the ancestors of the people that were living in these villages. So it might sound a little wacky, but between trying to make friends with all these little kids, and we always showed respect in the Buddhist cemeteries. We would keep the place clean, leave some offerings, and just be kind. There were a lot of Marines that picked up on that also. And so that was one of my survival techniques. And a little sense of peace and feeling as though I was trying to do something worthwhile.
Yeah. I guess, so you were going around, the villages, and not actually still doing the normal corpsman duties, but also distributing candy. I know, just from outside conversations that we've had, I think that you were injured at a certain point. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It wasn't, the candy was just for openers. So the kids, they all wanted the candy, and they all wanted the soap and toothbrushes, and, you know, I was a walking drugstore, so to speak. And, it was carried a 60 to 75 pound pack with me all the time. So, I was a pretty strong individual, and, one thing that had me worried, I was 6'5", so I made a pretty good target. But I didn't wear any kind of a armband or Red Cross or anything like that. I just tried to fit in and not seem have an aggressive demeanor about me. You know, you can tell, people can tell just through body language and demeanor, overall demeanor, if somebody is aggressive or if they're benign, so to speak. I tried to put forth as much of a benign type aura, if so to speak, and not seem as though I was there to be aggressive. And I think that helped. But then, being wounded, the end of August 67, I had an R&R to Tokyo. And so I had a great time. It was the first time I cleaned up. I was able to clean up. I was out all that time prior. I'd been out in the bush. I never had a real bath or a shower. It was just always washing in a stream and just grimy, cruddy looking. As a matter of fact, I'd cover myself with mud a lot of times just to be able to, as part of the camouflage, trying to, I look weird a lot of times just being. anyway, So, yeah, I went to Tokyo, a place stayed in a New Fujiya Hotel in Atami, Japan, outside of Tokyo, and I was able to clean up, hot baths, you know, warm, you know, nice bed, sleep in a bed,
yeah.
Good food, nice people, nice ladies.
Yeah. Can you describe a little bit of the experience there, you know, on our trip? You know, I've heard other times, you know, people discuss it, or, you know, it's oftentimes something you just go and then you end up coming back from. But I'm interested to hear, you know, what was that like, being there?
It was like waking up from a bad dream. It was like waking up from a nightmare.
Really?
And, yeah. So I was
there. Was there a sense of safety?
Oh, for sure. Oh, it was such a relief. Because I didn't feel like, you know, there was no sense of danger there. You know, there are times when you can literally feel certain atmospheres just exude danger. And there is no atmosphere of danger there. Beautiful ladies, really good food, sights to see. And once again, there were I was really starting to become interested in the Buddhist culture and Buddhist temples and visited. And, like I say, I was trying to make friends with the spirit world. And, so it was a wonderful experience in, Tokyo. And, so it was the beginning of first week of September 67. There was a monsoon going on. And I remember, of course, I liked the sake quite a bit, the rice wine.
Yeah.
I was a little bit loaded the whole time I was there. I had a flask of, you know, I indulged in sake quite a bit. And remember, there was one time a monsoon going on, and I was on top of in the Tokyo Tower with a beautiful Japanese girl with me. And the top of the tower was swaying. It was holding onto the railing.
Wow.
And there's a monsoon going on all around us. And the tower was swaying. And I loved it.
Yeah.
You know, it was, just a real feeling of being alive.
Yeah. I'm sure that must have been wonderful.
Yeah. So, shortly thereafter, well, as soon as the monsoon clicked, I was like 3 days late in getting, I had to check in all the time to figure out when the flight back to Da Nang. And there was a military desk there where we had to, at the hotel, I had to check in with the military. But, all right, what's going on? When do I, you know, when's the flight day? What flight? Whatever. And so September 7th, 1967, I flew from Tokyo back to Da Nang. Once again, it was a, you know, nice continental Boeing 707. I was in clean civilian clothes and had a wonderful time. It was 10 days in the Tokyo area. And so I got back to Da Nang, and looking down outside of the plane, there at the base of the steps was a Jeep with a Marine staff sergeant and a Special Forces staff sergeant in a Jeep with an M60 machine gun. And I recognized them, and so I got down and walked down and went to the Jeep, and I said, "Hey guys, boy, this is great service." here you are, you know, you're giving me an armed escort back to the my wonderful, you know, this wonderful area. And they said, and they had all my gear with them. And they said, Doc, we called the corpsman doc. They said, Doc, I hope you had a good time in Tokyo. Yeah, you know, you're a little late. I said, hey, guys, you know, there was a friggin' monster. Not my fault. You know, I wasn't malingering or lollygagging or anything. So, you know, there was, you guys are here. You know what the program is more than I do. Here you are. And, they said, well, I hope you had a good time, Doc, because you're going out tonight with the team into an area that you know. And there's a NBA rocket company out there somewhere, and you guys, along with several others, you're going to be going out and try to locate them. And I said, oh, wonderful. So they had luckily they had all my gear with them. And most of it anyway, but I got back to the base camp, and I loaded up with more stuff. And I thought, here we go. And I kind of had a premonition. When I was in Tokyo, I had a dream. I had a premonition that I was going to get hit. And so then I realized, here we go. So I went out with a 7-man team and as a corpsman, loaded up with as much, you know, with a lot of morphine and Dexamils and whatever. We all took, there's another controversial thing. And if we're going out on an ambush or at night, I'd issue each trooper a Dexamil, half Dexedrine, half Milcon, half speed, half tranquilizer. And I didn't do them to get high, but it would help keep us awake, cut our fear, cut the hunger. And I hate to say it, but Dexamils actually helped me get through. I didn't do them to get high, and I didn't do them take Dexamils all the time, but most of the time, if we're going out at night on an ambush or something, we knew we were going to get into some stuff. Everybody got a Dexamil so he didn't fall asleep.
Right.
And so I knew we were going to get it. So I popped the Dexamil and I had a bunch of morphine with me, luckily. I gave each trooper a Dexamil and gave them a syringe of morphine. And I said, well, we figured that something's going to happen for sure because we knew we were going into a bad area. And as a matter of fact, it's the area that later on Lieutenant Smoyer got killed. And along with 16 other guys. So meanwhile, we went out and looking for these guys, and they hit us before we saw it got to them. It was almost like, I think it might have almost been a setup deal too. Because I think one teenage kid who was kind of a snitch, you know, I hate to use that term, but there was one kid that ratted out where the North Vietnamese were. I never saw that kid again, but I think he was. Anyway, we got information as to where to go and look for these guys. And then so we bring in some artillery on them or airstrikes or what have you. Well, sure enough, we walked into a world of shit. And that's where I got hit by a grenade. And so it was like being hit by a bolt of lightning and a freight train at the same time. Unfortunately, the radio man took it. I thought I got hit worse than I was. I had pieces of the radio man all over me. And, you know, smell and feel of burning flesh in my face. Luckily, I had a flat jacket on. and they just picked me up, threw me back, slammed me down into a rice paddy. Fortunately, I was right next to a dike, a rice paddy dike, which protected me from gunfire and explosions and whatever. And excuse me, so I got slammed down, had the breath knocked out of me. I couldn't breathe. I'm gasping for breath. Had pieces of burning flesh in my face. Wind knocked out of me, and it felt like my whole body was on fire. You know, I could feel my legs, my feet, but they felt like they were on fire. And I didn't have control. I couldn't control moving them. And I thought, shit, here I am. Well, I'm gonna, if I live through this, I'm gonna end up on a friggin' neurosurgery ward. And, so luckily I was able to, the only thing I could really control was my left arm. And, I felt blood pumping out of my neck. A piece of shrapnel went in luckily it nicked the carotid artery. It didn't sever it, but I was pumping, just squirting blood out of my neck. And, here we go. Wounded in my right arm, my elbow was pumping blood out of that one. So I was able to, I always carried a bunch of surgical rubber tubing with me for tourniquets. So I was able to wrap my, when I collected myself, I was able to wrap a tourniquet around my right arms and stem, the only way I could stem the bleeding hemorrhaging out of my neck was stick my fingers in the hole of my neck. And I thought, oh, here we go. I'm going to bleed out. I didn't know. I thought the carotid artery was severed, but I was able to staunch the blood flow from just my fingers in the hole of my neck. And I could feel the blood pumping out of the carotid, and I just kind of squeezed it off that way. And I must admit, beforehand, I knew we were going to get hit. So I shot myself up with a stiletto of morphine, too. I figured, okay, if I get hit, I'm not going to go into deep shock because I already have some morphine in me. And I popped the Dexanil, which picked me up, leveled me off, gave me energy, controlled fear a little bit. And, once again, I didn't do it to get high, but, you know, I shot myself up with a morphine syringe, thinking that, okay, if I do get hit, which I did get hit, it's one reason why I don't think I went into deep shock. And, so the radio man hit, no radio communication. We were about almost a mile away from, a couple of clicks away from our base camp. So one guy, luckily, was able to run back to the base camp. One guy wasn't hit too bad, was able to run back to our base camp and let him know where we were or what was going on. I just lay there watching, it was like 4th of July, watching all this crap go off and trying to keep myself from bleeding out and guys yelling and screaming, you know, Corman, Rick, you know, they're calling my name, Rick. And I couldn't talk. All I could do is like gurgle, you know, it's like all the breath was knocked out of me. Luckily, there was one guy, Sergeant Walsh. Bob Waltz. His father was a doctor. Sergeant Waltz was a Marine sergeant, but he was also, he was probably as good a medic as I was. Anyway, he grabbed my kit and, he knew I couldn't function. And, so Bob Waltz grabbed my unit one and all my gear and tended to the wounded guys as best he could. Meanwhile, crap going on, explosions and shit, you know, weird. I thought, now here it is. This is it. This is how I end up. But once again, I try to make my peace. Make my peace with the spirit world. You know, pray to God. And lo and behold, a couple hours later, a medevac chopper came in and got to us. And so I got loaded on. I was like pretty, you know, I figured if I pass out, if I go into deep shock, I'm dead. So I just hung on as conscious as I could. And actually started hallucinating. You know, I saw my grandmother and grandfather's spirit, the doctor. And they loaded me on a chopper with the dead and wounded as quickly as they could. So I flew back from where I'd gotten hit, about the same area that Lieutenant Smyer got killed later on, into Da Nang and kind of in and out of a, what you call an out, in and out of a body, out of a body experience, you know.
Yeah.
And I kind of was in contact, I guess it was Dr. Sayo, or you're hallucinating. I said, well, I had the choice of joining my grandparents who had been deceased or live. And you had a choice. I thought, I was so scared. I thought, well, I want to live. So when I got back to Da Nang, I was just about out of it. I mean, I almost bled out. And so they gave me an IV, a whole blood. I could see them administering. They had a bag of blood and felt the blood, literally the life re-entering my body. And at that point in time, I realized, wow, I guess I'm going to live. But I didn't have control of my legs or my feet. I thought, well, shit, at least I'm alive, but here I go. I wonder if I'll be on the same ward in Oakland. So,
yeah.
They, stabilized me that night, and then the next morning they choppered me out to the repose, and I could feel the sensation coming back into my legs and my feet. What I had was actually spinal shock. You know, they just piece of shrapnel still stuck in C5, cervical vertebrae 5. That came real
close.
What
was that like? Sorry to interrupt you here, but what was that like, the feeling all of a sudden realizing that you were both going to live and that you were regaining feeling in your arms and legs?
Well, man, it was like a sense of relief, but, you know, how I still didn't know if I was going to make it. I thought, I don't give a shit. If I could... I could still be paralyzed. I don't know, infections or whatever. There was a whole myriad of situations. I didn't think I was totally out of the woods at that point in time. But when I got to the next day, when I was on the repose,
where was it?
Yeah, on the hospital ship repose, and it was in Da Nang Harbor. They choppered me out, and I was on a litter. Type thing, you know, basket. And so they cleaned me up and, you know, IV and everything. At that point, normal saline and with antibiotics, real strong antibiotics. Well, they closed the wound in my right arm. I debrided it, cleaned it all out, and sutured that up, and put a drain in my neck, cleaned that out, but they couldn't put a drain in my neck. And thing hurt like hell, but, you know, they gave me shots of whatever it was, Demerol, morphine, I don't know. They gave me some painkillers. So I was kind of flying high a little bit, you know, and I thought, wow, hey, I made it. Thank God I made it. Oh, wow. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Lord. And where do I go from here? You know, but I couldn't totally control my, I wobbly, talk about, I could sit up and had wobbly legs and feet. And so a couple of days later, I got pretty much full use and strength and coordination. At that point in time in my life, I was a very strong individual. I had really good muscle tone, and, you know, I was strong. And I thought, well, I'm going to direct my energy, all the strength and energy I have, into healing up. And so a couple days later, I was able to drag myself up. I made inquiry as to how I could radio patch call home and let them know that I was still alive. And so I was able to drag myself up to the radio room a couple of days later and called home. Was able to radio patch back. My dad was working in the Mercantile Building. His office was in the Mercantile Building in Chicago. While I was over there, they had moved from Chatsworth, California to Northbrook, Illinois. My dad was working in Mercantile Building. So I don't know how I did it, but I was able to radio patch. I just told the shortwave guy what I was trying to do. And sure enough, he got a hold of my dad in his office.
Wow.
Yeah. And my dad was kind of shocked. And he said, wow, this is incredible. This is, I mean, wow, Rick, this is a little miracle. I mean, this is wonderful. I mean, he was a little bit speechless, too, because simultaneously that same night, his boss's son, Eric Mueller, class of 66, Dartmouth class of 66, Eric Mueller was killed, not in the same place, but the same time that night, September 7, 67. So my dad was kind of overwhelmed with emotion. We were both overwhelmed with emotion. And then he told me that, yeah, Eric Mueller died and was killed the same time you were wounded. And so we were both, you know, I was still in a state of shock. I think my father was in a state of psychological shock, too. But at least I let him know that I was alive and okay, I was going to make it. And so from there, we were on our way to Subic Bay, Longapo in the Philippines. So the repose made it to Subic Bay. And so bit by bit, I felt my strength coming back to me. They had the drain in my neck and pumping me full of antibiotics. And luckily, it didn't get badly infected. And they acknowledged, they said, wow. They went in and did something to the carotid artery. I said, man, I can't believe that it just nicked it. It didn't sever it. And so it cleaned me up, stabilized me. I had sutures and stuff in my right arm. I still couldn't use my right arm, my right hand. I was in a sling. Stainless steel sutures. But I was determined to get up and about, get going again. And so even with an IV, and you know, I was carrying the IV around just trying to get my sea legs under me again. And bit by bit, I gained strength. But I made the mistake of recovering too quickly.
Really?
So on board the Repose in Subic Bay, we got there, I don't know, what was it, like 5 days after I was medevaced on board. I think it was 5 days later. It's all kind of, man, it was blurry at the time, you know. I was in a fog. Talk about being in a fog.
Sure.
And so I got up and about on the Repose and actually was able to get out, go out on a Liberty into a Longapo with a drain coming out of my neck. He had a drain coming out of my neck and my right arm in a sling, yeah.
Wow.
And so once again, I made friends with a Navy nurse. Another Lieutenant JG, so I invited her out. Well, let's go to dinner, you know. I mean, hey, I'm alive. And somehow I got a hold of some money. I can't remember how the hell I got a hold of some money. But hey, where do we go? Let's go out and have dinner and have some drinks and enjoy it. So I'm alive. I got to celebrate. And so we went to a place called Papagayo's in Longapo. And had a good meal and had a big drink out of what they called a big bamboo or something. So between the painkillers and the big bamboo, I was feeling no pain. So we get in a jitney, and what was her name? Carol Burton, or is her name? Lieutenant J.G. Carol Burton, beautiful gal. Her brother was a chopper pilot, and so... Meanwhile, we had nice conversation and all that. And nothing totally physically, if you know what I'm talking about, materialized, but the desire was there. And I was, I told her, I'm falling in love for sure here, you know. Anyway, feeling no pain. And, but she was very correct and proper. Anyway. So in a jitney, we're ready to go back to the Repose, and I feel my arm, my left arm, shaking. And I look over and there's a little kid popped off. I had a Seiko dive watch, you know, waterproof Seiko dive watch.
Yeah.
This little kid popped my watch up. My left arm is shaking, and I look over, and there's this little kid grabbing on my watch, and he popped it off. I said,
"Oh my gosh!"
I said, "Son of a gun, man!" I just went flying. He went running down an alleyway, the back alleyway, and I was determined to get my watch back. So I go running down there with a drain in my neck and my right arm and in a sling. And all of a sudden, a swarm of these little kids came out with their butterfly knives.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and they were like little piranha fish or something, I said. And the driver was yelling and screaming. The nurse was yelling and screaming. No, no, no.
Oh, my gosh.
I wanted to get my watch back, yeah. So, okay, so all of a sudden I realized about a half a dozen kids come out with these butterfly knives. And they were not big kids. All I could do is reach down and grab some gravel and some sand gravel and throw it at them and try to kick at them and get away. You know, they cut my shirt open a little bit, flicked a button off and cut them off. They just about cut me, and I thought, oh my God, here I am. Am I going to, no, I can't get killed here. I thought, oh, man, what have I done? And so I just turned around and beat feet and these kids yelling, but luckily they didn't finish me off. They could have finished me off.
Yeah.
If they want. You know, the kids like piranha fish with butterfly knives. So I got my adrenaline going back. I went running back. I looked down. And my shirt was cut and the buttons, and I said, get me out of here. Let's get out of here. Get out of here. So I never went back into town after that.
That's funny.
That was my experience in Longapo, and just stayed on board the Repose. And I thought maybe I could get sent home, you know. I thought, geez, I don't know if I can function too well back. But sure enough, they needed corpsmen, so I was on the Repose after being hit 6 weeks later. They steamed back to Da Nang and sent me back with my unit.
How much time did you have left in your service?
That was October, in October, and I had March until March.
Oh, well. Okay.
And so I got back to my unit and went out back to the routine again. And then I turned 21. November 12th, I was out in a friggin' mud hole somewhere. No, actually, I spent my 21st birthday. I thought, no, I'm not going to spend it in a mud hole. I'm going to spend it in a Buddhist cemetery. So I spent the bulk of my 21st century, my 21st birthday, at night in a Buddhist cemetery, saying my prayers.
Well.
Yeah.
Spiritual. And how was it, you know, was that almost a turning point for you? Did anything change, you know, having returned after such a traumatic experience? Did you feel any differently or, you know, for the remaining time that you had there between October to March?
I went back to the feeling of here it goes, you know, the fear and anger. But not, I overcame the anger with feeling as though I was very thankful. I was fearful, but I didn't want the anger to take control. And so I became very humble and just prayed to God I get out of there.
Yeah.
Once again, in and out of villages and helping take care of kids and this and that. And in, you know, in between different firefights and take care of wounded Marines, and it was like, okay, I'm back in hell again.
Right.
And so I experienced, you know, from when I went to Tokyo, it was like waking up from a nightmare. And then when I got on board the Repose, it was glad to be alive, but it wasn't like total out of the nightmare. But being sent back was getting sent back to the nightmare again.
Yeah.
So
with that in mind, what was it like, you know, sort of near the end, when you were approaching March, when you were March of 68, correct? When you were able to.
You get what's called, you've probably heard of short timers syndrome.
A
short time of experience. And so, February, March, the first part of March. You know, the Tet Offensive. Oh, yeah, well, okay, so.
Yeah, obviously, yeah. If you could talk about that a little, I'm interested
yeah.
to hear what extent that actually affected you.
Well, yeah, after my 21st birthday, of course, you know, and then the Tet Offensive comes. In January of 68. And so I thought, okay. And I've been up on a observation thing on a trail coming right off of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And we saw these guys coming down like ants. And we figured this one's the forerunner of the Tet Offensive. And VC, North Vietnamese, everybody coming down off this trail. I was with five other guys were up on a big pile of rocks watching these guys come down. And then we had a radio with us, but we had to maintain radio silence because it was just 100 feet away. These guys were coming down like ants. And no noise control or anything. They're just streaming down. And I thought, oh, shit, man. Here comes, yeah, it's going to be Chinese New Year. And they're getting ready. Man, there's going to be something happening for sure. And so we were supposed to be looking for, and it's probably something I shouldn't talk about altogether, but well, it's a long time ago. So we were supposed to watch out for Chinese guys, Russian guys, Cuban guys, what have you. And one of the deals was we coordinated with the snipers. And one thing I didn't mention is, which I do need to mention, is Carlos Hathcock. He was a famous Marine Corps sniper. He actually saved our butts when we were in the duck fall. Because he had a match-grade Modus 50 caliber machine gun with an 8-power inertial scope on it. And when those M16s were dysfunctional, he would cover us. We'd go out and he'd cover us with that Modus. So then, meanwhile, when we got transferred back up to Dai Lok area, the snipers were based off of Hill 55. And our base camp, my base camp, Kilo Company, was Hill 10, about 5 miles west of Hill 55. And so, but we would interact with the snipers, you know, we'd go out and find out where the bad guys were and then take snipers out, okay, play a shell game, drop them off different places. Okay, so one of the things we were doing watching these guys come down was to relay to snipers down below if there were any officers they could pick off. It's just the way it worked. Excuse me. But anyway. I was up there several days watching this stuff go on, and when we got back down to my a base area, it was a place called, what was it, Anois. There was an old French airstrip there. And I told a gunny sergeant, I said, "Gotta put me in the friggin' brig, man. I mean, the shit's going to hit the fan. These guys, man." I said, "Yeah, the gooks are gearing up. There's going to be a bad deal come up. You know, this Chinese New Year thing is going to be a bad deal." And our base camp, they were getting ready. They were withdrawing from a couple of base camps. And I said, "Man, I'm not even supposed to be on active duty anymore. Put me in the friggin' brig. I won't live through this. You're not going to send me out there again. Uh-uh. No way." I said, "I'm not going to defect. I'm not going to desert. I'm just going to sit my butt down and go in a bunker and get prepared to whatever's going to happen. But either that or I'm not going out. I'm just not going out on any kind of a patrol, ambush, nothing. I'm staying. I'm going to get in a bunker or put me in the brig." And he said, this guy said, "Doc, there was a Air America C-47, DC-3, blue and white, on the airstrip." And he said, "Doc," he went and talked to some people. And I thought, well, he's going to make provisions to take me to a brig or something. He came back and he said, "Doc, get on that plane. It's going to Thailand. It's going to Bangkok."
Really?
Yeah.
And what did that mean?
Well, I got on the plane. There were a bunch of spooks you know, CIA spooks, they were getting out of there too. They were on their way to me. So I went to Bangkok, Thailand, in an Air America C-47 with a bunch of spooks and stayed with them. And they told me, you know, hey, don't be a flight risk here. You know, we don't want to have
to. Yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to want to take off. You're not going to want to leave, okay?
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
And how long were you in Thailand for?
It was, once again, about 5 days. It was a blur.
Right.
I was pretty much loaded the whole time. And had a, you know, a couple of girls, different girls and whatever. And I was staying in what they called a safe house. It was a hotel, but these spooks were into having a good time too, going out and celebrating. So we all went out and celebrated and whatever. And I was pretty loaded. And determined to have a good time, which I did. You know?
And this is,
yeah.
Is this like late January of 1968?
No, this was the end of, now wait a minute. It was first part of January, second week of January, whatever. Okay, time-wise.
So this
it was
prior to the
Tet Offensive. The Tet Offensive kicked off while I was in Bangkok.
Okay, so like January 28th around? Or
just prior to that, 20th. Yeah. Yeah, around that time. And so, meanwhile, I had to get back, you know, it was like, what was it, a week? 5 days, 7 days there. Man, I tell you, I was pretty well loaded the whole time.
Right. I guess January 30th rather than, yeah.
Okay. And so then I got back to my unit and they said, okay, well, I got back to a base camp and so they didn't send me out in the boondocks anymore at that point in time. And so I thought, okay, February, got to make it through February. You know, okay, so what happened was, oh, here we're flying back in on the C-47, and we're flying around over Da Nang, and they're watching the rockets and stuff come in. They're looking down, and the pilot was circling around, and one dude got up and yelled at the pilot, get us the F out of here. Because there were some tracers started coming up at the plane we were in. You know, there was flying, you know, shit, there was fighting going on down below. And so then I had to go down. It was rough duty. We had to fly down to Cameron Bay for another few days.
Yeah.
Are you there? I'm getting some kind of notification.
Yeah, no, yeah, all good. Yep.
So that was my Tet Offensive experience. But then I had to go back to my unit where, okay, and then the end of February, the first part of March, I was luckily, well, I just had to go out on road opening patrols and your road sweeps at that point in time. I didn't have to go out on daytime patrol or nighttime ambush. I just went out on road sweeps as a corpsman and then had to go along with some convoys and different things. It was considered pretty much light duty at that point. But then I got volunteered 2 weeks before I come back to the States. I got volunteered to go out. And I had to take back Mike Company Hill, which had Mike 37 had been, they withdrew from there, and there was a lot of ordnance still there on the hill and VC all over the place. Well, naturally, for a short-timer thing, they wanted to make sure that I had a full experience of my tour in Vietnam. So 2 weeks before I flew out of there, I got assigned, volunteered to go back and help take back Mike Hill. But luckily, what saved my butt, and it saved a lot of guys, was some of these villagers, these kids, realized word got around somehow the Candyman is coming down. And what, believe it or not, some kids came back, come flying up the road, and came up to me and said, "Doc, you know, go down, don't go down, Buku, BC, Buku, North Vietnamese." They told me, "Stop, you walk into an ambush." These kids told me, that there was a big ambush waiting for us.
Well,
and yeah. If these kids didn't come flying up and tell me, these kids that like me, word got around, you know, the doc, Boxy, they call it Boxy, Candyman. You know, go there. And then, bingo, there was a whole bunch of them waiting for us. And then a big firefight again. And, man, if it wasn't for those kids, and I told the lieutenant there, I said, "Lieutenant, hey, these kids tell me that, you know, there's a big ambush waiting for us." So here we're walking down the middle of a friggin' road, and luckily there are a couple of tanks behind us and all that. So after these kids told me, bingo, bang, you know, they opened up on us. And I flopped down in a big tire rut, you know, truck tire rut in the side of the road. And these kids took off. They were okay. They made it all right. And, but, man, they started shooting the crap out of us. And I was in the big tire rut. And I think, oh, here we go again. Yeah, here we go. I got 2 weeks left. And I started saying my prayers like crazy again. And luckily, the M-48 or M-60 tank come flying up the road. And the gooks are shooting at this tank, bullets flying off the tank. I thought, oh, shit, man, he's coming right up. He's going to come up. If he straddles me, the bullets are going to deflect right down into me. And luckily, the guy stopped. The tanker stopped, but the 90-millimeter muzzle was right overhead. And he cranked off a beehive round and just, man, knocked me silly. I mean, it rung my bell, bounced. I mean, the muzzle blast from that 90-millimeter right over me. And rang my bell and it blew out, ruptured my right eardrum. I still have the ringing in the ears. Severe tinnitus from that ever since. But luckily the tank took care of business. And between the Marines, the tank, and then the air artillery came in. And I still think if it wasn't for those kids, it could have been a slaughter. But that was 2 weeks before I came home.
That's some stuff.
And so, yeah, 2 weeks later, I was able to get my ass out of there.
All right. So I just wanted to confirm we are recording again, once again here. We are, I guess we're discussing the, you know, sort of the last, you know, your last experience in Vietnam and in the feeling of coming home.
Yeah.
And if you could describe to me what that was like. I know you had mentioned that going on your R&R trip to Tokyo was sort of like waking up from a nightmare.
Right.
What exactly how would you describe this experience, finally going home?
Well, yeah, I made it to Da Nang. And one thing I made provisions to be able to take at Browning High Power, my pistol back with me as a, I declared as a war souvenir. I stated, you know, I made, filled out papers that I'd actually captured it. And, I'd captured a whole bunch of our unit. We had captured all sorts of weapons from the time, you know, we were there. And, you know, I'd captured different kind of guns, or, you know, we laid claim, so to speak, to all sorts of BC weapons. And in the process, I was able to get some paperwork made out that I had captured this Browning pistol. And so I had paperwork with me. I had the pistol and my things. Well, when I left Vietnam, I didn't have much stuff. All my gear had been blown up, you know, and during the Tet Offensive, and afterwards, my sea bag and most all my gear got blown up. So I didn't have much stuff with me, but I had that pistol, and I was back in Da Nang, and the next morning I was going to catch my flight date. Well, naturally, I went out and got a little bit loaded. We were all celebrating, you know. And I got pretty well inebriated, and I had that pistol under my pillow at the Da Nang Naval Support Facility. And somebody, somehow, they knew I couldn't believe it. While I was sound asleep, of course, I was a little bit inebriated. Lo and behold, somebody slipped that pistol from right underneath my pillow. I couldn't believe it. So I woke up.
Wow.
I woke up. Yeah, I woke up, and the gun belt was gone. I had a gun belt with a K-bar knife and canteen, different things, whatever, on my gun belt. And everything was gone. And, oh, did I get pissed off. I looked around and started yelling, who the hell took my gear, my pistol? And I only had a couple of hours to go before I got on the plane, got the hell out of there. So I went and complained to an officer who was, you know, a duty officer and all that. And I had the paperwork, you know, as a claiming it was a souvenir, and I was able to take it back with me. So all of a sudden I was totally pissed off and angry and all what, you know, to hear this thing had helped me through. It saved my life, literally. It saved my ass, because the M16s, and I didn't trust those M16s at all. I didn't want to carry a long gun to begin with anyway. But that pistol had made it through all of, including when I had gotten wounded, and they relieved me of that and then gave it back to me when I got back. But anyway, a pistol meant a lot to me. And here, rage, just total rage and anger. And I said, well, Doc, look, forget it. You know, you're flying out of here today. You're going back to the world. You know, what does that thing really mean to you? And I said, you know, I started thinking, shoot. You know, it's like, I can't let my head get carried away too much here. You know, forget the anger, forget, you know, material stuff.
But
so when I got on board that plane, Continental 707 again, I was still raging mad about the whole deal. But then when I got on that plane and sat down in the seat and looked at beautiful flight attendants, stewardess, they called back then, and they handed us a beverage. And I looked around and I said, what the hell am I angry about? I'm getting the hell out of here. I'm on a friggin' civilian plane going to take me back to the States. There's a couple of beautiful women, and I've actually made it. I said, I don't care. I don't care if I don't have anything material with me. Take it all. Just leave everything there. Forget it. Which I did.
Yeah.
I just had the clothes I was wearing, and that was it. I just left everything behind. I didn't have that much to begin with, really, but I was just wearing the friggin' dirty, dusty utilities that I was wearing, you know, all mud cape and everything, and greasy, grimy, you know, with the jungle boots. I was just wearing the, like, I was just right out of the bush right there. I'm not sitting on the plane looking around, and I thought, all I could think about was being able to take a shower because I smelled really bad.
Yeah.
And and my head was, you know, I had a little bit of a hangover, and I started thinking, damn, just leave it all behind. Leave all material, anything material, just leave it behind. Thank God I'm out of here. You know, and then once the plane, we were still, all I could think about is like when I come back from Thailand, watching the place at Da Nang had been mortared and, you know, rocketed and all that. I said, man, I'm not safe until, you know, they could start rocketing this place again. Because the last time I'd been in Da Nang seeing the airfield, it was getting mortared and rocketed. And so once we got airborne and everybody started cheering, and it wasn't until we got out over the ocean and looking down and all I saw was ocean, then I thought, wow, I actually made it out of there. And so what a relief, you know, but it was still, I had so many emotions flying through me, but then all of a sudden a feeling of numbness came over me. I just, there was a feeling of relaxation, but then all of a sudden I felt numb. Like,
do you
okay.
Talk about the bubble?
Sorry?
Do you want to explain that a little? Like, what do you?
Well, it was just such a, I think it was, I was overwhelmed with so much emotion. I think my nervous system's shut down for a little bit, you know, when I was on that plane, I just fell sound asleep. I just felt this numbness come over me. And so, and then I just got tired. I had to go to sleep. And so I slept, I guess, for a couple of hours. I just sound asleep. But I woke up and it was just this, still a feeling of numbness. It was, I don't know, it was such a mixture. It was elation. How do you explain numb elation?
Right, yeah, it's just difficult.
Yeah, it was very...
Sorry, go. Sorry. I was going to say, do you feel like this is something that everyone, you know, sitting next to you in the plane, everyone returning home, shared? That this was a sort of a collective experience, or is this something that you felt was sort of more unique to you?
I didn't compare notes with anybody. It was pretty much unique to me. I was just, you know, we were, you know, it was before people were high-fiving, but in effect, you know, we were all waving, and there was a lot of jubilation going on and all that, but I didn't compare notes with anybody. We were just glad to get the hell out of there. I didn't know anybody on the plane. I got out of there by myself. I didn't know anybody else. And so, yeah, it's hard to explain the combination of so many different emotions, but a feeling of numb elation, it's hard to describe that, but I just all of a sudden became very, very tired. I had to go to sleep. And so I slept most all the way from the flight to Okinawa. And Then I woke up. I woke up and I got off the plane, but then I had the shakes real bad. And I couldn't stop shaking. And I thought, oh, shoot. And I was sweating and shaking, and I thought, oh, man, I'm coming down with malaria. And I thought that's what it was. But part of it was I was coming on, going through withdrawals from Dexamils. Because, like I say, I didn't take them to high, but to get high, but I was used to taking Dexamils several nights a week while I was there, just out in the bush, you know, going out. And so I got addicted to them. And I didn't realize I was addicted to them or dependent on them. And so I literally went through, you know, cold turkey and shakes and sweats and all that. But when I got to Okinawa, luckily I was able to meet he wasn't a blood uncle, but he was just like a really, really super close friend of the family. He was a full bird colonel, Pete Spear. He was a Air Force missileer colonel. And so luckily when I got to, Okinawa, I was able to give him a phone call. So Colonel Spear came and picked me up with his wife and daughter, Angie, and you know, just super nice people. And so I was able to actually stay with Colonel Spear and his family for a couple of days while I was going through processing. I thought, well, maybe it's a combination of malaria but I had the craving for a Dexamil. And I realized, I got addicted to these damn things. And, so I didn't, you know, just being truthful, I didn't say anything to anybody for years afterward about it. I thought, well, I explained it off. I was obviously sweating and shaking and different things going through with withdrawals, but I actually thought, well, maybe I'm coming down with malaria. So I checked with a medical officer and I said, you know, I've got some malaria coming on board here. And they said, okay, well, when you get back to the States, we'll check you out. So that was my excuse for sweating. It turns out I didn't have malaria, but that was because I have been strung out on Dexamils. Like I said, I didn't do it to get high, but it helped get me through. And a lot of guys, I can't say all the Marines and everybody I've talked to since come back and through the years, there's only certain units that were issued. They said, well, now I had to sign for everything. It wasn't like I was doing illicit medications or anything.
Right.
I had to sign for this stuff and keep track of it and all that.
And was this something that, you know, coming back, you know, was there anyone who could help either sympathize with you or help in this process? Or was this something that truly you and I guess so many others had to deal with on their own and just have, you know, just let time pass until this went away? Was there any treatment offered to you? Or it was not something that was spoken of, or?
No, when I got back, landed in El Toro Marine Air Base, and then we got transferred up to Long Beach where I got separated. Well, I checked into Long Beach and I said, I got to talk to a medical officer. I thought I was coming down. It was a combination of malaria, what have you. And they said, well, yeah, we'll have to check you out and this and that, whatever. But as it turns out, I realized I'm just going to have to deal with this myself. And when they tested me and it wasn't malaria, and I just realized that, I just got to deal with this, you know, just toughen up, screw up your guts, toughen up. I've made it through so much crap. I said, I'm not going to let this get to me.
Yeah.
No, I was very strong. I was pretty tough back then. You know, I was a very strong individual physically. I don't know about mentally, emotionally, but I just had to rely on my inner strength to get through. And it was just, you know, it was just a week or so later that I mellowed out. But I went up to California first, you know, to Chatsworth, saw an old girlfriend and some friends, but then I didn't have anything going on there. My folks had moved to Northbrook, Illinois. And so I just wanted to go and see them. And by the time I got to Northbrook, I stopped the shakes pretty much, and you know, the withdrawals.
Right.
And so I got to my staying with my folks in Illinois, and so it was good to see folks, my family and brothers and this and that, but I didn't have much going on in Illinois. I wanted to get back to Connecticut, where I had most of my friends. You know, I grew up in Connecticut and all that. So I didn't spend what?
Well, you know, you had mentioned that your father was a P-47 pilot. He was, you know, he had been a prisoner of war, and he had served. Was there any sense of, you know, that you guys had some shared experience here, or was this something?
Well, my father had his own form of PTSD, which I didn't totally understand until later on. But my father and I did not have the best relationship. Like I say, when my dad got back from Europe, got together with my mom, his high school sweetheart, she got pregnant right away. And I don't think he was ready to have a kid right away. You know, it was like, all right, lived in Middle Fairweather Hall and a bunch of screaming kids crapping their diapers and whatever. And he spent most of his time in the library. And let me put it this way. I never had to lack for anything, really. Well, if I wanted something, I earned it myself. But I can't say that he didn't love me, but there was not a real, he just wasn't ready to have a kid right away. And my dad, I felt a certain amount of animosity toward me when I was growing up. And so that carried on. We didn't have the best communication all through junior high and high school. I lived in a cabin out behind the house in Westbrook. Well, you know, teenage, adolescent, rebelliousness and all this, I just clashed with my dad. And he was a hardcore type A personality, climbing the corporate ladder. And I didn't want to go along with his program of being a big-time New York executive, and I'd gone into New York many times visiting his place, his work in New York City. I knew New York City inside and out and this and that, but I realized at that point in time I didn't want to become part of the corporate world because I grew up listening to his corporate war stories and all that. And he didn't sense that I really respected his position as a big-time McGraw-Hill executive. So when I got back to Northbrook and all that, you know, everything was cordial, this and that. But people were glad to see me, but I didn't feel like hanging around the family too much. I just wanted to go back to Connecticut and maybe get back into school. You know, get a job, just kind of come down from all of this. But I had more going on in Connecticut area than I did in California or Illinois. So I didn't stay in Illinois very long. I got back to Connecticut. And so, yeah, I told my dad, yeah, I'm going back to school, Dad, trying to get my grades up. Yeah, I don't know. I said, Dad, I don't know if I'll ever make it to Dartmouth. I love the place and all that. Wonderful. Good memories. But I told him, you know, Dad, I really don't think I'm Dartmouth material. it's like, it's stuck in his craw when I tell him, I don't know if I'm Dartmouth material. So, anyway, I got back to Connecticut and there was protest stuff going on and this and that. And, I thought I checked in. I was going to check in with University of Bridgeport. I had to check in with Bridgeport Naval Facility. There it was. You know, that was my draft card. Selective Service was based out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. So, and of course I had to check in with the Naval facility in, Bridgeport. So I was looking around and I ran into a situation where, protesters and this and that. I didn't take too kindly of a guy spitting on me and calling me the baby killer. So I ended up putting the guy in the hospital. Just the way it was.
And how was that experience? Was that sort of a, not universal, but was this something you felt in a lot of ways that you were not welcomed for your...
I did not feel welcome one little bit. I did not feel welcome back one little bit in Connecticut. Well, with a couple of friends, but as far as school situation or what have you, it was hard to not, you know, it was obvious I was like, I guess I wore the military. I wore the military appearance all over, you know, it's like, it's one of those situations whereby then I just felt like, screw this place. I'm going to get out of here. So I had the opportunity. I was given an opportunity, a choice of either go to Africa or South America.
And where did that take you?
So I ended up gone a couple weeks later in the jungles of South America. And I was, well, just a, not a combat or military mercenary killer kind of guy, but I was a contract kind of, what do they call it, a contract. Because I was a survivor. I knew what it was like to live in the jungle. I knew, I thought I wanted to be, they offered me a job to learn how to be a bush pilot. And, I'd learned the basics through my dad years ago. I was not a licensed pilot, but I could fly a small single engine fixed wing. And, so I thought, okay, well, I get down and I was a base camp corpsman, a foreman back in the jungle. And, once again, it was, well, at this point in time, I can't talk about too much, but I was, let me put it this way, I was not a hired killer or anything like that. But, I ended up being a dive master foreman, a base camp foreman, and, a dive master and whatever. So I had to sign a letter of non-disclosure, which I still better honor. And, As it turns out, I got into a, I'll just say this much, I got from the frying pan into a fire. Didn't realize exactly what I was getting into. And so I think I'm the only one alive out of that whole thing that went on down there. So I'll leave it at that. And when I got back, I got out of South America and went back to University of Bridgeport. Tried going back to school, University of Bridgeport, Connecticut. And once again, I was a matriculated student, accepted at University of Bridgeport in the business program. And I was going to, you know, my dad said, well, you're not going to any junior college. You're not going to community. You're going to go full time, you know, be a full time student. And you're going to take business courses or I'm not going to help you. And the VA was, at that point in time, the VA was worse than useless. And I was not too happy about a few things. And so meanwhile, I got sick, you know, down in the jungles. I got dysentery, amoebic dysentery, and some infections and different things. My wisdom teeth, all of a sudden I had impacted wisdom teeth. One reason why I had to get out of, and it saved my life, because I had to get some medical attention and get back to the States, which I tried at Bridgeport and through the VA, and the VA was worse than useless. And then Bridgeport is right near the Sikorsky helicopter plant, is right nearby. And I went to class for a couple of months, but I couldn't, you know, helicopters flying all over the place, day and night. And I couldn't concentrate on studies. And so once again, then I was defecating bloody worm stools. I had impacted wisdom teeth. I had an infection in my scalp. And I had to get some medical attention. The VA would not help me. And so I had to go to private practice, doctors and dentists. And so it was just impossible for me to be a full-time student, go through all of that, listening to these helicopters and having the medical problems I was having. I just dropped out of school. I had to take care of my health. And it took me a couple of months to get back together again. And then I realized, well, no more military. The military offered me a situation. I said, forget it. No, you're not going to send me back to Vietnam. I'm not going back any place where anybody's trying to kill me. And so I thought, well, I had a friend living in Aspen, Colorado. So I decided I was going to be a ski bum in Aspen, which I did. I moved out to Aspen, Colorado.
Well, and yeah, well, thank you so much for sharing so much about your experience there. And obviously, we could go forward and talk about like other, you know, ways that this has affected, you know, going forward and just how big of a experience this is in your life.
Well, I would like to talk, just to wrap it up, finish it up, Matthew, so in Aspen, I think we talked about it before, I became a police officer, and they needed somebody to do mountain rescue. I was, I worked with search and rescue, and I was obviously a paramedic. Well, I was pretty much what you call a paramedic. I could handle weapons. I could handle aircraft. Choppers coming in. And so that was my main dude. I became an Aspen police officer, but then I ran into some political problems. I learned what corruption is all about in Aspen. And so then I had to leave there. a couple of years later. And I was an asking cop from 69 through 71. And I had to get out of there. And I moved back east, and I moved up to Woodstock, Vermont, the state, you know, Brook Hollow Farm, where I learned, you know, when I was a kid. And I thought, well, what the hell am I going to do with my life now, you know? So I thought, well, maybe I'll go on to be a, you know, advanced paramedic. And Dartmouth, they had, there was a thing called the Medics program. So I went, at that point in time, I was advanced EMT, going on to be a paramedic and all that. And I thought, well, maybe I'll become a physician's aide assistant, you know. But working in the emergency room, Mary Hitchcock, man, it was just, you know, no war casualties coming in there, but accident cases. This was in 1971, 72, 73, that era. And Vietnam was still going on. It was winding down, but then I learned what PTSD is all about. And I ended up with severe nightmares, and, you know, I just couldn't handle emergency room stuff, and I just fell apart. And what they call PTSD back then, I knew it as combat trauma neuroses. So I went to the VA for help, and all they wanted to do was turn me into a friggin' vegetable, shoot me up with Thorazine. And that was not going to work. So at that point in time, I developed a hatred towards the VA. And there were a lot of Vietnam vets coming back, and we got treated like crap. And, you know, everything I did, I tried with the notion of duty, honor, country. And I was getting treated like crap. And that's when they call PTSD. I told them, hey, I knew I was experiencing clinical depression. And because when I was working neurosurgery next to neuropsychiatric, I knew the basics of what was going on. But back then, the VA, all I wanted to do was deal on a Freudian basis. They didn't want to talk, acknowledge when I went through a program at West Haven, Connecticut. And that was called a T-group therapy group. And there was a guy, Dr. Ben Burstyn. He was the head shrink for Yale New Haven. It was, you know, Yale Medical School. And couldn't talk about Vietnam, couldn't talk about the military. Talk about your childhood, your sex life, your family relations, and nothing about Vietnam. It was verboten. Oh, why? Because, oh, it's too upsetting. And all they wanted to do is turn, you know, and we were all combat veterans on this war. Didn't have to be. Had to be there overnight, weekends take off, during the day take off. I'd go over to Yale Medical School and study what I could about going on. And, you know, the DSM, then I learned what the origins of the DSM is. And then I confronted this doctor about, I said, hey, you know, this Freudian crap isn't going anywhere. And, let's talk about the origins of the DSM. Well, he didn't want to do that. Of course, it was started out by General William Menninger and Colonel John W. Appel. They were the ones that started the DSM with World War II, studying combat, psychiatric, psychological combat casualties. So I'll leave it at that. I had to educate and not educate, but I had to pull a few doctors up short and say, hey, you know, they wanted to classify me as a schizophrenic or something. They said, you know, this is not getting it. I had to tell them what was going on. I said, I've obviously got clinical depression, you know, reactive clinical depression. And, you know, you can take your schizoid diagnosis and shove it where the light doesn't shine. So I still kind of have that attitude a little bit.
Do you feel like in the years since that there's been a market change? Do you feel like, or you still feel that, you know, the VA?
No, the VA has turned around a lot now. After I left Woodstock, I went down to take care of my grandparents in New Jersey. I was married to the gal. I moved out of Aspen with a gal. Met in Aspen and we got married. We were together, lived together about 5 years, but in 76, the marriage kind of fell apart, and that's when I realized that, yeah, I'm not going to be a PA. I can't deal with the medical thing anymore. And so I decided to become I was a horseshoer. I liked horses, working with horses. And, so I drove, when I was at Woodstock, I drove a bus, a school bus. I was a horseshoer and an arborist, working the trees. I was like a monkey in the trees and shoeing horses. I had to work outside, and part of it was hard physical work was also a stress reliever. And so that's what I determined, that I'm just going to have to work outside and do hard physical, you know, as hard physical labor as much as that, because I enjoyed it back then. And I was, at that point in time, I was still a very strong individual. And
right.
So when I left Woodstock and went back to New Jersey, took care of my grandparents. And my grandfather, father's father, was dying of cancer. My grandmother had a stroke. So I did what I could as being like a house orderly. like a LPN for my grandparents while I was there. And took care of them for a year, and then I moved back to Aspen when I realized that. And the sheriff, who I'd had handcuffed to a radiator while I was a cop, he was gone. He got run out of town. He was a security guy at a casino in Reno. And the chief of police there, when I was there, took a job as the chief of police in some mafia town in Illinois. So I said, you know, before I learned how corruption works when I was in Aspen.
Right.
So I moved back to Aspen and I became a ski bum photographer. Went back to, I got a degree in photography from Colorado Mountain College. I drove a bus and I drove trucks. And I did security work. They wanted me to be a deputy again. My buddy of mine had become the sheriff. And I said, no, I'm not going to do anything where I get shot at or hazard. But I did security work.
Yeah. And I guess, like, yeah, and going through all these different positions and stuff, and obviously.
Yeah.
What do you think has been, just to sort of, yeah, I guess to sum up the talk and experience we've had here, just to not make it too, I would ask, what do you think has been what you've carried forward from your experience to today? If you want, like, if you have any words about, you know, your experience that you'd like to convey, a concluding statement.
Well, here I am 73 years old now, and time flies. It's like, man, you know, I kind of sort of feel like I'm still 40 or 50, but old war wounds have caught up with me. I still got the shrapnel and C5, and I've got a bum knee that I busted the patella in a chopper crash, and now and that started it off. So I've got physical things going on and the psychological stuff. I'm a member of a group, you know, support veterans, combat veterans support group out here in Grand Junction. They have a now the VA here is really good. Up until 99, you know, the first Gulf War in 90, the VA was forced to get its stuff together with the recent, you know, since Desert Storm, Desert Shield and all that. They were forced to get their shit together. Now they have quite a bit. And, I'm back in 99, 2000, I call it being cashed out. I was designated 100% disabled through unemployability because I'm unable to do what I was educated for, or also job experience. I can't, and I don't want to do law enforcement anymore. I can't physically drive big rigs. I was, up until last year, I still had a license to drive any size truck, including hazmat, on the road. But it got to the point in 99, 2000, I couldn't do that anymore. That's when they decided that, okay, they gave me temporary 100%, the VA did, and through unemployability. And I can't ski anymore. I was a ski photographer in Aspen, snowmass, drove truck, did security. They don't want me doing that anymore. And part of it is an attitude situation, but more of a physical situation. But at the same time, I'm part of a VA combat veterans support group. And the PhD psychologist monitors the situation. So I've been, ever since 99, 2000, participate in combat veterans support group. So without getting into current events and all of that, Iraq, Afghanistan, that's another whole ball of wax. You know, I have friends that are veterans from both. And that's a whole different subject. And here it is. They made a lot of the same mistakes as they did in Vietnam with Afghanistan and Iraq. And what can I say? I mean, I'm not, I'm pro veteran. I'm pro any kind of a combat veteran that's gone through combat. You know, they're modern day heroes. You know, of course, there's a lot of good and bad. There's a lot of bad. It's a controversial situation, and now here we are. You know, we got to extricate ourselves. What?
Would you serve again? Would you do it again?
Yes, under I would, yes. Under different, I would not go on, knowing what went on in Vietnam. I would not allow myself to go through that again. The only thing, the good thing I see about now Vietnam, they realized that hardcore communism doesn't work. Here they, the Chinese, they don't trust the Chinese and they don't trust the Russians either. You know, we've got, the free world has more commerce going on with Vietnam now. They realize that maybe it's not true capitalism, which is, you know, pure capitalism has its own evils, but pure communism is even worse. But, man, look at all the stuff, the commerce that's conducted in Vietnam now. And not saying that it was a good thing that the way it happened and all that, but I think they realized that our way of life is better than a hardcore communist way of life. So just kind of leave it at that. I have a few friends, Vietnam friends, and I actually know one guy that was a VC. You know, after when we left, the Americans left, and the North Vietnamese took over, a lot of people don't realize a lot of the boat people were actually South Viet Cong families. Because the hardcore North Vietnamese, when they moved into South Vietnam, they either killed or re-educated all the intellectuals in South Vietnam. And a lot of people don't realize that.
Yeah.
And a lot of people bailed out of there. There's one guy here in town. Well, he's ethnic Chinese, really. I won't go into detail, but he's the kind of guy that worked both sides, if you know what I'm saying. Then he realized the hardcore communists. He was forced into stuff, but he realized hardcore communism just doesn't work.
Right. Well, thank you so much for, you know, sharing everything today and communicating your story and your experience and everything. It's so powerful, and I truly appreciate it, and we really appreciate it here, the DVC in general. If you have any concluding remarks or anything you really want to get across, I think this has been great so far, and I think
I appreciate the opportunity to talk about my experience in Vietnam, but I would like to wrap it up with one thing that we mentioned. Second Lieutenant William Smoyer, who was a Dartmouth graduate, he was a lieutenant, second lieutenant with the same outfit that I was attached to. Well, Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines. And he got there, it was a couple of months after I left, along with a corpsman, Wayne Carone, who was kind of a replacement, filled my one. They were always short of corpsman. So 2 weeks after Wayne Carone, HM3 Wayne Carone, corpsman, and Lieutenant William Smoyer, they arrived together. They were with my same unit, same area that I was in and out of, and all the stuff going on with the villages, being wounded and all that. 2 weeks later, 16 of them were killed in the same area that I was wounded in. And, you know, Second Lieutenant William Smoyer was a great, you know, athlete at Dartmouth, great guy. Killed 2 weeks after he got to Vietnam, along with Wayne Carone, was subsequently posthumously awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor, trying to save Lieutenant Smoyer and 15 other Marines. They were slaughtered.
Well, yeah. And these are, the Dartmouth, obviously this certainly circles back to what this project is all about. And we've had other, interviews and conversations with his, family members and people who knew him well at Dartmouth. And I think that really understanding your experience in your words.
I didn't know Eric Muller. He was class of 66, but he was the son of my father's boss at the time. They were close. And, I've read about Lieutenant Smoyer. He was a great guy. And, it's just one of those things. I was born at Dartmouth. I just had that connection, learned to ski up there and just loved the area, loved the place, lived up in Woodstock. So the whole ambiance is just wonderful up there. But, now we have another controversy on with a pandemic going on. And, I really feel whether or not people realize that we're entering, it might be little far fetched, but it's almost a World War III thing going on with this Chinese virus deal. Because in the whole world is impacted now. And Dartmouth was particularly impacted recently, as I understand. But luckily, I live in a place. Yeah, Mesa County, where I live in Grand Junction, there's 153,000 people here. There's only 40 people have contracted the virus, and nobody's died here.
Right. That's, so, yeah, that's definitely good to, that's definitely a good thing to hear. And I think, yeah, we're all hoping to get back to, you know, to school and to normal life up in Hanover and
right.
in Upper Valley. And I think.
Yeah, so we're all gonna, a lot of people are gonna experience their own form of PTSD over this, whatever you wanna call it, the Wuhan virus. And, the Chinese did a number on us. And here we go. Along with the, Middle East problem and the Chinese problem. Well, once again, I'll wrap it up by saying the Vietnamese do not care for the Chinese program. And they don't care for the Russian program either. I think the Vietnamese identify with us more than they do the Chinese or the Russians. I'll just kind of leave it at that.
Well, thank you so much for everything you've, you know, given and spoken and shared today. And I truly do appreciate it. If we can close here, if that's feel comfortable, I wanted to say thank you again, and I can stop the recording here.